The amount of false information circulating in this year's election could be worse than 4 years ago.
We'll explain this Wednesday, October 30th, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Both presidential candidates are relentlessly hitting the campaign trail with less than a week to go.
My response to Joe and Kamala is very simple. You can't lead America if you don't love Americans. You just can't.
Meanwhile, as two people compete for the White House rolls out a new public tour, largely designed by First Lady Jill Biden.
I have two boys that want to touch everything and every museum that we ever go into, and now they're going to be encouraged to do that.
And a review of the new movie, A Real Pain.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Democrat Kamala Harris is campaigning in Raleigh, North Carolina today, saying Americans should stop pointing fingers at each other. Harris looked to push past controversial remarks that have come from all sides in the election, saying it's time for voters to make their voices heard.
We need you to vote early, North Carolina. Because we have just 6 days left in one of the most consequential elections of our lifetime.
Remarks by a comedian at a Trump rally this past weekend referring to Puerto Rico as an island of garbage generated controversy, and comments made after that by President Joe Biden, in which he appeared to call Trump supporters garbage, continued the vitriol. Harris is also making campaign stops in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin today. Former President Trump, meanwhile, is campaigning in Wisconsin. The Republican presidential candidate will be joined by retired NFL quarterback Brett Favre. The appearance comes despite the fact Favre is currently embroiled in a welfare spending scandal in his home state of Mississippi. He's among three dozen people or groups being sued as the state seeks to recover misspent money from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program there. Less than a week before the election, a top U.S. cybersecurity official says there's no evidence any foreign adversary has broken into American election infrastructure. NPR's Jen McLaughlin has more.
Just days before polls close, federal officials are working to reassure Americans that elections are secure. Jen Easterly is the head of the Department of Homeland Security's cybersecurity agency, CISA.
We have not seen any evidence of foreign adversaries getting into our election infrastructure.
Easterly says she will speak up if that changes. She also says it would be nearly impossible to change the outcome through hacking, thanks to the decentralized, diverse nature of election infrastructure, near universal paper ballots, and auditing systems. However, she warns that foreign adversaries might try to falsely claim that results were compromised. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
The U.S. economy grew at a robust rate in the July, August, and September quarter. NPR Scott Hostler reports on the latest economic report card from the Commerce Department.
The nation's economy grew at an annual rate of 2.8% in the third quarter, a modest slowdown from the previous 3 months when GDP grew at a 3% clip. The slowdown primarily reflects a drop in inventories and residential investment. Consumer spending, which is the main driver of economic growth, actually picked up some steam. That spending is largely fueled by a strong job market and rising wages. A survey released by the Conference Board this week showed the biggest jump in consumer confidence in more than 3.5 years. The news comes just days before a presidential election in which voters have consistently named the economy as a top issue. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow fell 91 points today. This is NPR. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says there's evidence North Korean troops wearing Russian uniforms and carrying Russian equipment are moving toward the Kursk region, what appears to be a dangerous and potentially destabilizing development. Speaking at a news conference with South Korea's defense minister, Austin said concerns are mounting over Pyongyang's deployment of as many as 11,000 troops to Russia. In New York tonight, the L.A. Dodgers get another shot at winning the World Series, while the New York Yankees will again try to stave off elimination. Steve Futterman reports.
The New York Yankees are trying to do something no team has ever done, win the World Series after losing the first three games. To do that, the Yankees must win four straight. With an 11-4 victory in Game 4, the Yankees won the first of those four last night. New York Yankees third baseman Chaz Chisholm embraces the challenge.
We've always stayed positive. Nobody's ever had hung their head down in here. Hey, we love making history. So that's what we're trying to do right now.
Even with last night's loss, Los Angeles still has a huge advantage. The Dodgers have to win just one of the next three. They are hoping that will come tonight. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at the World Series in New York.
It may not be as exciting as finding or uncovering a T-Rex or mastodon, but scientists say they have found the oldest known fossil of a tadpole in Argentina. They say the tadpole wriggled around some 160 million years ago, surpassing the previous record for such a fossil. Researchers know frogs were actually hopping around as long as 217 million years ago, but how and when tadpoles evolved into frogs is not clear. This is NPR.
You are listening to NPR on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
We are expecting strong thunderstorms to continue moving through the Manhattan, Junction City, Abilene, Chapman area for about another 10 minutes. Not quite to the threshold of severe thunderstorms, but they are strong and they are dangerous. Severe outdoors, you need to get indoors. We will continue to monitor the weather for you. We are expecting severe weather tonight. The time is 4:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Heading into Election Day and the days of vote counting that will follow, the information environment online has arguably never been worse. One of the major social media platforms is owned by a billionaire who is pushing false election conspiracy theories, and the former president is still almost daily calling into question the integrity of the vote. NPR's Miles Parks and Shannon Bond are here to talk with us about how all levels of government are preparing. Hey to you both.
Hey there.
Hi, Mary Louise.
I mean, when I say it's hard to imagine things online being worse, I'm thinking back to the 2020 election. We, of course, had all kinds of misinformation, and it contributed to thousands of people rioting at the U.S. Capitol. Shannon, you kick us off. Your reporting suggests the landscape this year might be worse.
Yeah, and as you said, I mean, there are some big factors here, including former President Trump, who continues to spread false claims about voting. And he is now being amplified by Elon Musk, the owner of X, who's become his most prominent surrogate. And on top of that, we're also seeing many of these falsehoods and divisive narratives being picked up and spread even further by foreign nations like Russia and Iran and China, who federal officials say are trying to sow chaos and discredit American democracy. We spoke with Kate Conley, who oversees election security issues for the Department of Homeland Security's cyber agency. Here's how she describes it.
Going into the 2024 election cycle, we are arguably facing the most complex threat environment compared to a prior cycle.
And so in the face of all that, Conley told us a big part of the strategy at the federal level is really to just amplify the voices of local election officials. She called those the signal through the noise.
Right. I mean, as you nod to, voting is run at the local level in the U.S., so you've got these thousands of local officials, Miles, but I mean, none of them have a megaphone that remotely compares to Elon Musk's or Donald Trump's.
They don't. And I think this cycle, they've started to kind of realize that. I talked about that with Carolina Lopez, who's a former election official from Miami-Dade County, who now runs an organization called the Partnership for Large Election Jurisdictions.
Election offices throughout the country spend a whole lot of time producing content for social media. And it always kills me when I see like three likes, and it's usually themselves and their mom. So I think election officials are trying to figure out, well, what else can I do to be heard?
So this cycle, what that looks like is a lot more press conferences and briefings for local news reporters and the public, just trying to educate people on exactly how their processes work ahead of the votes starting to be counted. These local election officials, though, are not really used to the limelight. Mm-hmm. But this cycle, there's just been this really, really clear recognition that they can't just sit back and wait and be defensive. They have to be proactive about some of this stuff.
And we're also seeing the federal government being more proactive, calling more of the stuff out publicly. Like just last week, there was this fake video going around of ballots being torn up in the swing state of Pennsylvania. And just a day later, we had intelligence officials come out publicly and say it was a Russian fake. We just haven't seen them move that quickly before. But I will say, Mary Louise, federal officials are really focused here on foreign actors who spread election lies. There's just not the same kind of effort to call out and warn Americans about, you know, falsehoods that might come from domestic sources. Of course, that can get into really fraught territory for the government because of the First Amendment. And it's also become a big line of attack for Republicans. And so that means a lot of this pushback and debunking is falling to local officials.
Okay, so that is some of what local and federal officials are trying to do. What about the tech platforms themselves? Because in past, of course, they have tried to limit the reach of false election information, and then they got accused of censorship. So, Shannon, how are they approaching election information at this point?
I mean, the starkest change really is at X. Musk himself is a huge source of false and misleading information about voting. That has many people really worried, right? Because X is small, but it remains influential. But as you said, you know, there are these accusations of censorship, and we've seen other platforms, including Facebook and YouTube, also retreat from what had been more aggressive approaches to countering election lies in 2020. And what we've been hearing for several years now is that amid all this pressure, everyone is just much more gun shy.
And then you add on top of that, what makes this really challenging for local election officials is that the landscape keeps changing. Isaac Kramer, who runs elections in South Carolina's Charleston County, told me he's been seeing a lot of false voting information on the community posting site Nextdoor, for instance.
It's difficult because there's a million different platforms out there, and we can't possibly have eyes on every platform and see what everything is being posted.
The time that voting officials are most worried about is after the vote has been completed, but counting is still going on. This information void has notoriously bred falsehoods, and Donald Trump has already made it clear he is not scared to declare victory even when he hasn't won.
Yeah, I mean, these officials have spent years now.
We interrupt our broadcast of All Things Considered to bring you a severe thunderstorm warning from the National Weather Service in Topeka. This is for southeastern Dickinson County, southeastern Geary County, and Morris County, and it's in effect until 4:30 this afternoon. A severe thunderstorm located 5 miles north of Burdick, moving to the northeast at 50 miles an hour, 60 mile an hour wind gusts reported with this set of storms. You can expect roof damage, siding damage, tree damage. Locations affected by this set of storms include Harrington, Council Grove, White City, Dwight, Wilsey, Parkerville, Latimer, Council Grove Lake, and Burdick. Again, we do have a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Dickinson County, southeastern Geary County, and Morris County until 4:30 this afternoon. Stay tuned to KPR. We will be back at any time when more warnings are issued to try and keep you safe. Stay weather aware for the remainder of the afternoon with KPR. We now return you to All Things Considered.
This century, the term DANA is a Spanish acronym for high-level isolated depression. That's when cold air descends over the warm waters of the Mediterranean Sea, leading to the formation of dense, towering clouds in a matter of hours. The storm left images of destruction, especially in the region of Valencia in the east. In the town of Picanha, neighbors watched how an entire bridge was swept away by an overflowing river. Here, a concrete wall is taken down by a river that has taken over the streets. The rain was expected, with the National Agency for Meteorology alerting almost a week ago that torrential rain was on the way. But there was no indication that things could get so deadly.
Lo principal es expresar el pésame y la tristeza por tantas pérdidas de vidas humanas.
Wearing a military uniform, the King of Spain, Felipe VI, lamented the deaths and the destruction caused by the storm. Over 1,000 soldiers from Spain's emergency response units were deployed to the devastated areas. Police and rescue services used helicopters to lift people from their homes, and rubber boats to reach drivers trapped on the roofs of their cars. The devastating rainfall also stopped some rail and road travel in the worst natural disaster to hit Spain in decades. Scientists say increased episodes of extreme weather are likely linked to climate change. Miguel Macias, NPR News, Seville, Spain.
No matter who wins the White House next week, they will be expecting tourists. About 10,000 people a week visit the presidential building. Until this month, they got a public tour which had not changed in decades. NPR's Alejandra Marquez-Hanse went on a newly revamped White House tour.
Since the last time I took this tour about 6 years ago, they've opened a new room to the public. It's the Diplomatic Reception Room, where President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the American public directly through the newish medium of radio. These were the famous fireside chats during World War II and the Great Depression.
The simple fact is that many million more people have private work today than 2 years ago today.
And you can listen and hear his voice and look in this room and imagine to yourself, this is where FDR made those fireside chats, exactly where I'm standing right now.
Elizabeth Alexander is the communications director to First Lady Jill Biden, who spearheaded these changes. When Biden spoke at the unveiling, she said she wanted the new tour to mimic a museum experience.
As a teacher for 40 years, I know that we all learn in different ways. Some of us learn something through hearing. Some of us learn something through feeling something. So we've added a dynamic, flexible, and tactile tools of learning that let you follow your curiosity.
Like in the green room, where Elizabeth Alexander points to an urn used for tea or coffee that's almost 240 years old.
It's roped off because it belonged to John and Abigail Adams, but what you can do is you can feel a replica of it. And so I know I have two boys that want to touch everything and every museum that we ever go into, and now they're going to be encouraged to do that.
For visual learners, there are digital slideshows with photos of past presidents, a scale model of the White House that shows key renovations the building has endured, and now you can actually walk into a lot more rooms, like the luxurious Blue Room.
So this is the Blue Room.
There's a new sign that notes that back in 1863, President Abraham Lincoln greeted visitors here hours before going upstairs to sign the Emancipation Proclamation.
Previously, people didn't know it. They would walk through the Blue Room and admire the furnishings, admire the beautiful view of the Washington Monument and the Jefferson Monument that you can see, but they may not have realized exactly what has happened in this room across history.
The Biden administration worked with the White House Historical Association, the National Park Service, and the History Channel, which provided the funding. Alexander says that collaboration helped enhance the tour while also preserving history. And she adds, this is an ongoing project.
The president, no matter who they are, is only a temporary occupant of this house, and it really is the people's house. And so this tour, this public tour and its elements will adapt and change as presidents change.
For example, the tour includes video greetings from Joe and Jill Biden, which the next White House occupants will also record. Alejandra Marquez-Hanse, NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered on Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence, 89.7 FM in Emporia. We are always online at kansaspublicradio.org, proud to be a service of the University of Kansas. Thanks for tuning in today. Coming up in our next half hour, former President Donald Trump has a new line of attack for Vice President Kamala Harris and President Joe Biden, after Biden made a comment that seemed to disparage Trump supporters that has been countered by the White House. And it all really comes down to punctuation. We're going to talk about it coming up on KPR. Stick around.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center of Johnson County Community College, featuring the Opus 76 Quartet, Christmas with the Celts, and more this season. Single tickets available at jccc.edu/Midwest Trust Center.
We do have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for southeastern Dickinson County, southeastern Geary County, and Morris County for about another 10 minutes. It's in effect until 4:30. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts with this storm. That is nothing to mess about with. Roof damage is possible, siding damage, tree damage. People in Harrington, Council Grove, White City, Dwight, Wilsey, Parkerville, Latimer, Council Grove, Lake, and Burdick. Be aware, this set of storms coming your way. We also have a severe thunderstorm watch till 7 o'clock tonight for Doniphan County in Kansas, Andrew, Atchison, Buchanan, Holt, and Nottoway counties in Missouri, and a tornado watch in effect For Chase County, until 9 o'clock tonight, we are expecting severe weather through the evening hours.
Support for KPR comes from Cromwell Environmental, providing solutions for mold, asbestos, and other indoor environmental quality issues since 1982. For clients ranging from private homeowners to realtors to corporations. More information at cromwellenvironmental.com.
It's 75 degrees in Lawrence, 73 in Topeka, 56 with rain, obviously, in Manhattan. It is 420.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. In Arizona, where there's a significant population of Native American voters, Democratic Senate candidate Ruben Gallego acknowledges his party has often taken Native votes for granted.
A lot of times, by the time Democrats pay attention to Indian country or tribal votes, it's usually the last 2 weeks we're like, oh man, we're down, we need to find more votes, like, let's get out there, right? It's just very disrespectful.
On the campaign trail for nearly 2 years, he set out to change that with hopes it'll pay off come election day. NPR's Ben Giles reports.
On a warm summer day in June, Johnny Lehigh stands a few steps off U.S. Route 89 in northern Arizona. He stares at a windswept expanse of red rocks, cliffs, and clay he hopes to soon officially call his own.
Elders fought for this, and the majority of them are not here no more to see what they pushed for.
Over two decades ago, the San Juan Southern Paiute tribe and Navajo leaders signed a treaty, setting aside this Navajo land for Southern Paiute people like Lehigh. Congress has yet to recognize the deal. It still awaits a vote in Washington. That leaves Lehigh and the Southern Paiute as the only federally recognized tribe in Arizona without a reservation.
It's a big step for us to actually have something of our own.
Alongside Lehigh stands Gallego, who says he supports the tribe's push to have a federally recognized homeland. And he, in turn, could use the support of tribal members to win in this swing state. Gallego made it a goal this campaign season to visit all 22 federally recognized tribes in Arizona. NPR traveled with Gallego on three of those trips. On a summer visit with the Hopi community, tribal leaders said they recognized the political power they wield and that Gallego hopes to tap into.
In the last election cycle, 2020, it was the Native votes in Arizona that overturned and made this a blue state.
Alfred Lamaquihue is the Hopi tribal registrar, and his boast is no exaggeration. The Associated Press analyzed voter turnout after the 2020 election. Increased turnout and support for Democrats on large swaths of tribal lands helped President Biden narrowly claim victory in a state Democrats hadn't won since 1996. Gallego's rival, Republican Carrie Lake, has sought to cut into that advantage. She's made multiple trips to the Navajo Reservation, the largest in Arizona, and has the endorsement of a former Navajo leader. But Gallego had a head start, having launched his campaign nearly a full year ahead of Lake. He purposefully spent part of his first day on the campaign trail back in January of 2023 on Native lands with the Navajo and White Mountain Apache tribes. And it's why earlier this month, he went on a four-hour hike to visit his 20th tribe, the Havasupai people.
After we're done with this, we're going to have to stretch our chins because we're not young men anymore.
There's two ways to get to the Havasupai Indian Reservation: a helicopter ride or an 8-mile, 2,000-foot descent into the depths of the Grand Canyon. Gallego, citing a phobia of helicopters from his years of service with the Marines, opted to walk.
So actually physically seeing it, seeing how they're attached to these causes makes a huge, huge difference and makes you want to fight harder because now it's not just this theoretical thing. You're actually seeing it, right? You're seeing how this affects them.
The trail, shaded by steep Red Rock Canyon walls on either side, is full of reminders of why Gallego didn't get here sooner like he planned. Shattered trees and debris washed away by a deadly flash flood in August. The flood briefly shut down the village of Supai, a world-famous tourist destination, to visitors.
I'm surprised he made it down and walked down. A lot of people don't.
4 hours later, tribal elder Dalia Manicaja looks on as Gallego, at hike's end, is welcomed by a ceremonial basket dance and lunch, supai tacos, made with the village's famous fry bread. While sometimes dangerous, the water is what sustains the Havasupai people. And while this might be a campaign stop for Gallego, for the tribal leaders, it's a unique opportunity to sway a sitting congressman and possible U.S. senator to their cause. They're concerned a nearby uranium mine may taint the aquifer that's the key to the tourism economy, but more simply, life in Supai.
Our water, that's very important, our water down here. That, you know, we need to keep it alive just so we can go swimming. We can grow our crops down here.
The tribe made sure Gallego got to experience the bright blue-green water of Havasupai for himself. As Havasu Creek cascades over a roughly 100-foot cliff, Gallego takes a hard-earned break after the hike. He wades into the basin at the foot of the falls. But time is running out to meet his goal of visiting all of Arizona's federally recognized tribes. With Election Day less than a week away, the campaign says he's still got two tribes to go. Ben Giles, NPR News.
In Brazil, the trial has begun for one of the country's most notorious murders. Two former policemen stand accused of involvement in the assassination of an iconic Rio de Janeiro politician back in 2018. Investigations into the case exposed rampant corruption among police and politicians. Julia Carneiro reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Justiça! Justiça! This was a long-awaited moment for the protesters gathered outside Rio's courts today. Calling for justice for Marielle Franco, they carried sunflowers, the symbol of the councilwoman's blooming career. It's impossible to underestimate how important a figure Marielle Franco was in Rio, a gay black woman from the favelas, advocating for human rights, gender and racial equality. When she was gunned down, aged 38, along with driver Anderson Gomes, shock and protests echoed around the world. The men facing trial are former policeman Rony Lessa, who's accused of firing the submachine gun, and Elcio de Queiroz, who's accused of driving the car used in the crime. They made a plea deal with the federal police last year, leading to a major turn in investigations. Rony Lessa accused two politicians and Rio's former police chief of being the masterminds behind the crime. Marielle Franco, he said, was seen as an obstacle to real estate expansion by Rio's powerful militias.
Marielle Franco's family has just arrived here at the demonstration. Her mother, her sister, her daughter are being hailed by the demonstrators with calls for justice.
In the courtroom, the defendants appeared on video conference from prison. First came the accusation witnesses, including Marielle Franco's widow, Mônica Benício, today also a councilwoman.
Vou fazer a pergunta primeiro para o senhor Rony. Senhor Rony, o senhor pode dizer o nome do seu advogado?
She says some politicians believe they can get away with murder and hopes this trial will show them otherwise. Outside the courtroom, the nation watches closely. The trial should be a clear message against impunity, says Jurema Werneck, executive director of Amnesty International in Brazil.
This is a very important moment. It's an opportunity to Brazil to change the page, to start a new history, to change the way we deal with human rights defenders and change the way we deal with justice and impunity.
For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio.
This is NPR News.
4 years ago, a near riot broke out at a polling center in Detroit, Michigan.
I heard banging on the windows. I heard chanting, "Stop the count, stop the count." It was a hairy moment.
How poll workers in the city are preparing for this year's election on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tune in tomorrow morning, 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
Support for KPR comes from Eagles Rest, a locally owned natural mattress and furniture store in Lawrence with heirloom quality furniture by Acornis, Copeland, Sisco Brothers, and Younger. Online at EaglesRestNaturalHome.com.
Still have a severe thunderstorm warning for portions of Gary and Dickinson counties. We are expecting that to expire. I will get you a complete weather update in just a few moments. It is 75 degrees in Lawrence, 74 in Topeka. It is 4:30, and news headlines are coming up next.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. No matter who wins the White House, one thing's for certain: political struggle around the Supreme Court.
Coming up, how this election could reshape the court.
Neither party would be likely to give a positive vote to a nominee of the president from the opposite party.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Both presidential campaigns are trying to rally supporters in battleground states with less than a week before Election Day. Republican nominee Donald Trump campaigning in Green Bay, Wisconsin, after an event in Rocky Mount, North Carolina today, where he made his final push to contrast his vision of the future to that of his Democratic opponent.
But whether we're going to have 4 years of incompetence and failure, or whether we'll begin the four greatest years in the history of our country, that's what's going to happen.
Vice President Kamala Harris is calling on Americans to push past negative comments and finger-pointing. Harris laying out what her team called the closing argument last night in front of her largest audience yet. Today she stressed unity and finding common ground. Arnold Schwarzenegger is the latest high-profile Republican to endorse the Harris campaign. NPR's Sarah McCammon has more.
In a lengthy post on X, Schwarzenegger says he doesn't normally do endorsements before announcing his support for Vice President Harris and her running mate, Tim Walz. Schwarzenegger says, quote, "I will always be an American before I am a Republican," and describes Trump's rejection of the results of the 2020 election as un-American. He warns another Trump term would leave the nation, quote, "angrier, more divided, and more hateful." The former bodybuilder and actor served as California's governor from 2003 to 2011. Schwarzenegger joins a growing list of Republicans, including former members of Congress, military leaders, and Trump administration officials who are publicly backing Harris. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
Well, stocks finished slightly lower on Wall Street after some mixed earnings results from Google's parent company and Eli Lilly. The Dow lost 91 points, down 0.2%. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. The severe thunderstorm warning for portions of Geary and Dickinson counties has been allowed to expire. We are still keeping an eye on the developing weather. We are still expecting severe weather tonight, and we are expecting it to have more effect than the severe weather we saw this afternoon. We're talking about 60 to 70 mile an hour winds. We're talking about hail. We could see a possible tornado. All of that yet to come. So we are watching that very closely. We currently have a severe thunderstorm watch until 7 o'clock tonight for Doniphan County, Kansas. Also for Andrew, Atchison, Buchanan, Holt, and Nottoway counties in Missouri. A tornado watch until 9 o'clock tonight, south and west of the KPR listening area. However, Chase County, which can receive the KPR signal, is in that area. So a tornado watch until 9 p.m. for Chase County. Stay tuned to KPR throughout the evening. We will certainly let you know if any watches or warnings are issued. In other news, new research shows food insecurity rose among children in all 105 counties in Kansas between 2021 and 2022. Food insecurity is defined as having limited or uncertain access to food, usually for socioeconomic reasons. The nonprofit Kansas Action for Children says one in five Kansas children experienced food insecurity in 2022. That year, the state saw its highest spike in child food insecurity rates in 10 years. Jessica Herrera Russell is with the nonprofit. She says the spike can largely be attributed to the end of pandemic era relief programs.
A lot of pandemic era programs really had far-reaching impacts on kids.
and a lot for the better.
Russell says Kansas lawmakers could ease food insecurity by reducing the cost of school meals and removing barriers to government assistance. A growing number of Kansas students are earning college credit while they're in high school, but a new report raises questions about whether most of them go on to earn a college degree. The Community College Research Center tracked more than 8,000 Kansas high school seniors who were enrolled in dual credit courses in 2015. 4 years later, about 60% had not earned any type of post-secondary degree. Kansas Education Commissioner Randy Watson, however, says the more college credit high school students earn, the better their chances are of completing a degree or certificate.
If a student can successfully complete around 15 credit hours, they're more likely to go on to some kind of post-secondary education.
About a quarter of Kansas high schoolers taking college classes are students of color. Nearly 100% chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening. Lows tonight in the mid-40s. Tomorrow, sunshine, cooler, highs in the upper 50s.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Well, it's less than a week until the last votes are cast in this year's presidential election, and the candidates are crisscrossing the country, making their final pitches. Former President Trump is doing so while dealing with lingering controversy from his major rally in New York City on Sunday, though he is hammering on a remark made by President Biden. NPR political correspondent Daniel Kurtzleben is following the Trump campaign and joins us now. Hi, Danielle.
Hey there.
So I see how every day is so packed with events this close to Election Day. What is Trump up to today?
Well, he was in Rocky Mount, North Carolina for a rally this afternoon. So not only a swing state, but that's also where there's this House district that Republicans have a shot at flipping from a Democratic seat. Now, tonight, Trump has a rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin, with former Packers quarterback Brett Favre. Now, as for his message, his rally today was mostly pretty standard for Trump. He talked about his plan to do mass deportations. He also talked about inflation. But also, as you mentioned there, he really railed against this comment that President Biden made Tuesday night. Biden had been talking about Trump's Sunday Madison Square Garden rally, where at that rally, a comedian referred to Puerto Rico as a, quote, floating island of garbage. Biden, in talking about this, stumbled over his words, and it momentarily sounded like he was calling Trump supporters garbage.
Huh. Okay, so you have this comment from Biden, and you have a series of racist and misogynist comments from that New York rally. Tell us how Trump addressed all of that today, did he?
Well, regarding the Biden comment, very much. He talked about that as if Biden insulted Trump supporters. But if you listen to Biden's full statement, grammatically, garbage refers to that insulting joke about Puerto Rico. But Trump is clearly seeing this as an opportunity to get out from under the shadow of this rally. He's linking Harris and Walz to Biden in the process. Here he was today.
You can't lead America if you don't love Americans, you just said. And you can't be president if you hate the American people. And there's a lot of hatred there.
And it really harkens back to Hillary Clinton in 2016 calling some Trump supporters a basket of deplorables. Well, Trump seized on that back then. And even today, some Trump supporters still claim that deplorables mantle. But all of that said here, let's keep in mind that Trump's message isn't exactly peace and love and unity. He, after all, has called the U.S. a, quote, garbage can for the world recently in reference to immigration.
Okay, well, despite trying to draw attention to Biden's comments, Trump is still fielding a lot of criticism from that New York rally, right?
Very much. The Trump campaign has distanced itself from that one specific joke about Puerto Rico, but they haven't really answered for the other vulgar statements made at that rally. And there were a lot of those statements about Kamala Harris, about women, about Latinos as a whole. Plus, Tucker Carlson told the crowd that leaders, political leaders, are trying to replace American voters, which is a reference to the racist great replacement theory. Mm-hmm. At any rate, Trump is doing this very broad cleanup. He has called the New York rally a love fest. And at a rally in Pennsylvania last night, he said, quote, nobody loves our Latino community and our Puerto Rican community more than I do.
Okay. So aside from that, it sounds like Trump gave a pretty standard speech at today's Rocky Mount rally. What should people be watching for in these final stops for the Trump campaign?
Well, again, his central message is always immigration, inflation, and isolationism. There's also often some grievance mixed in with that. But just as central to his message is his persona. He's unpredictable. He's often insulting to his opponents. He's recently been calling Kamala Harris low IQ or stupid. None of this is a policy position, but his faithful voters love that side of him. They see it as a sign of honesty. And that's honesty, they think, that's honesty that they perceive from a guy who also continues to lie about the 2020 election.
That is NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you.
Jesse Eisenberg's new movie, A Real Pain, is based on his own family history. Eisenberg cast himself and Succession's Kieran Culkin as polar opposites. Critic Bob Mondello says the result is an odd couple road trip comedy that surprisingly also prompts tears.
Cousins David and Benji have been best pals since infancy. Now in their early 30s, David is antsy, anxious, and neurotic, which is to say he's played by Jesse Eisenberg. Kieran Culkin's Benji is loose, cool, and to David's distress at the film's start, not picking up his phone.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system.
Boner.
Is not available.
Hey, Benji, I just got to the airport. I really hope you left already. God, you made it.
What's up, cuz?
They are headed to Poland on what someone will later call a Holocaust tour to see the village their late grandmother hailed from. Both have come prepared, David with a carefully planned itinerary, Benji with supplies.
Wait, you're not, like, taking weed into Poland, are you?
Oh, yeah.
Benji?
They don't give a shit about that stuff.
I think they very much do.
Arriving in Warsaw, they meet their mostly older group, which includes a recent divorcee, a Rwandan genocide survivor, and a guide who's not Jewish but says he's obsessed with the Jewish experience. In a way, so are David and Benji.
In some parallel black hole universe, you and I are Polish, and we probably got, like, long beards and we can't shake hands with women.
Yeah, that's funny. You know, every time I see like one of those Hasidic guys on the street, I always just think like, there but for the grace of no God, go I, you know?
What?
Oh, nothing. It's just like a dumb joke.
Oh, that's cool, man.
Benji's already moved on.
Look at her.
Who?
That woman, Marcia. She's walking alone. We should go talk to her.
We just met her.
Yeah, but she's got this like deep sadness behind her eyes, you know?
She does?
Yeah, you didn't notice that?
During the introductions? No.
I think we should check on her.
Benji, maybe she wants to be alone.
No one wants to be alone, Dave. Okay, I'm going to check it out.
Leaving David alone.
Hey, why are you walking alone? Are you a big loser?
Kieran Culkin makes Benji a force of nature, a man-child who's equal parts charming and exasperating. Whether he's insisting everyone acknowledge the weirdness of being Jews in first class on a train in Poland, or letting David miss their stop, then solving that by hopping a train back for which they don't have tickets.
We stay moving, we stay light, we stay agile. Yeah. The conductor's going to come through taking tickets. We tell him we're going to the bathroom.
Bathroom.
He gets to the back of the train, he's going to start heading towards the front looking for stragglers.
Sorry, where are the stragglers?
Yeah, by the time he gets to the front, the train's going to meet in the station and we're home for
this is so stupid. Tickets are probably like $12.
It's the principle of thing. We shouldn't have to pay for train tickets in Poland. This is our country.
No, it's not. It was our country. They kicked us out because they thought we were cheap.
Eisenberg's script and direction are clever at every turn. But the filmmaker is also adept at shifting the tone. Visits to a Jewish cemetery and a concentration camp that take the characters out of their contemporary pain and into historical trauma. All of this grounded in the real. When David and Benji separate from the tour group to look for their late grandmother's home, the house they end up at is one that was once owned by filmmaker Jesse Eisenberg's family. The characters' moments there are no less awkward and funny, but resonant? Enormously so. Which is this always surprising comedy's biggest surprise. Real feeling. Opinions may differ on which cousin is the bigger pain in A Real Pain, but by the end of their intimate road trip, Eisenberg's made sure that you're feeling both of them. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. One of the most beloved residents of the ecosystem around Yellowstone National Park has died. She was an often photographed grizzly bear known as 399. That's a number that wildlife biologists assigned her. 399 was the oldest known reproducing female grizzly in the area, and she died last week after being struck by a car. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach spoke to people mourning the loss.
My name is Tom Mangelson, year after year for 18 years. I would see her and her offspring.
Mangelson is a wildlife photographer that lives near Grand Teton National Park. People around the world got to know 399 through his photos.
I don't have kids, but I have a couple of special dogs and have had animals all my life, but I've never lost an animal. It affected me as much as 399 getting killed.
399 was known as a roadside bear. Grizzlies that survive to age 28, like she did, generally avoid people. But there's a hypothesis that some bears frequent roadsides to keep their cubs safe from aggressive males. This may cause them to fear cars less. Sam Nearman works in conservation and education in Jackson, Wyoming.
I mean, I think we are fully the guilty party here. We more or less nurtured this animal to, you know, feel okay being a roadside bear. You know, I say this with tremendous grief. This is like the logical death, right? A roadside bear being hit by a car.
My name is Joanna Allam, and I work at Teton Science Schools. I have a very vivid picture of my three-year-old hanging out of the car window, calling out, "I see you, 399. I shared the news with them last evening. My eight-year-old just dropped to the floor, kind of crumpled, and started crying. I think they felt very sad that it had been human-caused. It was really hard for them to accept.
I'm Renee Seidler, the executive director of the Jackson Hole Wildlife Foundation. Grizzly 399 made it really clear that there are bears in town that are searching for garbage, barbecues, birdseed, livestock grain.
Bears that learn they can find food like that in towns often frighten or get into conflict with humans, and that can lead to them being killed.
She was a catalyst for change for us to kind of get our ducks in a row on regulations and code and to work towards being able to enforce those things so that we really are living not adjacent to the wildlife, not in conflict with the wildlife, but living with the wildlife, with the wild animals being safe and us being safe.
Suzanne Turnbull lives on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation in Montana and takes care of bison sent there from Yellowstone National Park.
You know, as a Native American person, we feel, we believe that we're all related. So, you know, I see her as a mother, like I'm a mother, you know. So they're not just an animal, you know, they're a spiritual being as well. It's just really sad that that's the way it ended. But, you know, humans and wildlife don't always find a perfect balance of existence. She represented everything that is wild and free.
For NPR News, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson, Wyoming.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we bring you the latest on everything from the presidential race to what interest rates are doing. But we also share stories that take us into other people's lives.
You actually played your horn while they were inside your skull.
Absolutely. Doesn't everybody?
Listen for the unexpected with the news weekdays on Morning Edition.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations 5 to 9 a.m. Morning Edition will come your way. We will get you caught up on all the latest national, international, and regional news.
Support for KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, asking listeners when they last visited a dentist. For preventive checkup, dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 99.5 FM in Manhattan, always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up in our next half hour, news headlines. Then Ari Shapiro speaks with our White House correspondent about the ways in which Vice President Kamala Harris is working to win over voters in the final days of the campaign. As predicted, the severe threat has moved a bit to the east. We now have a tornado watch in effect until 10 o'clock tonight for the following counties: Allen, Anderson, Atchison, Coffee, Doniphan, Douglas, Franklin, Greenwood, Jackson, Jefferson, Johnson, Leavenworth, Lynn, Lyon, Miami, Morris, Neosho, Osage, Shawnee, Waubonsie, Wilson, Woodson, and Wyandotte counties in Kansas, Andrew, Bates, Buchanan, Clay, Holt, Jackson, Nottoway, Platte, and Ray counties in Missouri. We also still have that tornado watch till 9 p.m. for Chase County. So a large portion of the KPR listening area covered by this tornado watch until 10 o'clock tonight. Again, that means that conditions are good for the development of severe thunderstorms and tornadoes. You might remember that graphic that was going around a couple of years ago, where a person was taking a look at their kitchen countertop and they had all the ingredients for tacos sitting around. Okay, that would be a taco watch. And then once the taco is assembled and ready to eat, that would be a taco warning. So think of it in those terms. All the conditions are in place for tornadoes to develop. Stay tuned to KPR throughout the evening. We'll let you know if any develop and if any other watches or warnings are issued. But we do have a tornado watch now until 10 p.m. for the lion's share of the KPR listening area. This includes Topeka, Lawrence, Emporia, the greater Kansas City metropolitan area, Atchison, also the city of Chanute, also included in this. Be cautious, stay weather aware, have multiple ways to receive watches and warnings, particularly after sunset. These can turn up quickly. But just to make sure you are understanding the gravity of the situation, this doesn't normally happen at this time of year in this area. But I want to repeat those counties under a tornado watch till 10 p.m. Allen, Anderson, Atchison, Coffee, Doniphan, Douglas, Franklin, Greenwood, Jackson, Jefferson, Johnson, Leavenworth, Lynn, Lyon, Miami, Morris, Neosho, Osage, Shawnee, Waubonsie, Wilson, Woodson, and Wyandotte counties in Kansas. On the other side of the state line, Andrew, Bates, Buchanan, Clay, Holt, Jackson, Nottoway, Platte, and Ray counties. That does include Topeka, Lawrence, the Kansas City Metro, Chanute, all of the greater Kansas City Metro suburbs. It does include Kansas City, Kansas, City of Atchison. So stay weather aware. Stay tuned to KPR throughout the evening. We'll let you know if any other watches or warnings are issued. We now return you to All Things Considered, already in progress.
Likely to give a positive vote to a nominee of the president from the opposite party.
Democrats like to think of themselves as more responsible than Republicans, but the pressure would be enormous to do unto Republicans what they did to the Democrats. NYU law professor Bob Bauer served as White House counsel for 2 years during the Obama administration. He isn't sure what Democrats would do if the shoe's on the other foot, but
this whole notion of a certain process that has to be respected, regardless of the potential political impact on one party or the other, is not a norm because it doesn't command general adherence.
So what if Trump is elected and the Senate flips to Republican control? The only thing then standing between nomination and confirmation would be two moderate Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. If the margin is 52 to 48, their votes aren't needed. Vice President J.D. Vance would cast the tie-breaking vote. So what recourse would the Democrats have in a situation like that? How would they fight a Trump nomination? We would largely be left with the politics of personal destruction, investigating every aspect of a nominee's life to find something disqualifying, said one Democrat who spoke candidly on condition of anonymity. Of course, right now, there is no vacant seat on the Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor, at age 70, the oldest Democratic appointee, has said emphatically that she has no plans to retire. And while the deaths of Justices Scalia and Ginsburg prove that nothing is certain, they were far older than any of the current members of the Supreme Court. Today, the two oldest justices are among the most conservative. Clarence Thomas is 76 and Samuel Alito, 74. Some of the most politically active conservative thinkers would like to see them step down and be replaced by younger conservative judges who could serve for many decades longer and move the conservative needle even further to the right. But those who know Thomas and Alito are adamant that neither man would leave the court at this point. Several of their friends agreed to speak candidly about the prospect of retirement if they were not identified by name. What would Alito do, asked one friend? Go home and fly flags with his wife at the beach? The court is his life, said another. As for Thomas, while some theorize that he might enjoy retirement, his close friends say there's no way he would retire. They say he would see that as caving into his critics and essentially being driven off the court. Thomas is by far the most senior member of the current court. Indeed, after the next president is sworn in, the justice will be serving during his 11th presidential administration. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
My baby born a Birkin. She's been telling me all night long.
Ever since the middle of the summer, this had been at the top of the pop charts, a bar song by Shaboozy.
One. Here comes the two, to the three, to the four. Tell them bring another round, we need plenty more. Two-stepping on the table, she don't need a dance floor. Oh my, good Lord.
Well, not anymore. Nearly 4 months after taking the top spot, Shaboozy has been knocked off. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music introduces us to the new number one.
This week, Shaboozy was in position to tie the longest run of the 2020s, set last year by Morgan Wallen's 16-week chart topper Last Night. But instead, Shaboozy has been surpassed by Morgan Wallen. His new song, Love Somebody, enters the chart at number one.
I just wanna love.
Wallen also has another song in the top 10. His duet with Post Malone, I Had Some Help, has been hanging on for 24 weeks. Given the staying power of Morgan Wallen's hits, it may be an uphill battle for Shaboozy to reclaim the throne, but he's still lying in wait at number 2. Speaking of longevity, since Billboard started tracking music streaming about a decade ago, the charts have been a mix of the venerable and the ephemeral, especially on the album side. You've got your immovable objects who debut at the top and barely budge for months, Taylor Swift, Sabrina Carpenter, people like that, and then you've got your supernovas, Coldplay to name one recent example, who debut at or near the top only to plummet speedily into oblivion. One advantage of the current system with its fickle nature is that it can offer a snapshot of fan sentiment in the moment. After former One Direction member Liam Payne died on October 16th, one way fans mourned was to stream the One Direction catalog. This week, all 5 One Direction studio albums re-entered the album chart.
Seems to me that when I die, these words will be written on my stone.
Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
And I'll be gone, gone tonight. The ground beneath my feet is open wide. The way that I've been holding on too tight, with nothing in between. The story of my life, I take her home. I drive all night to keep her warm.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations with their food needs, with online ordering from a nationwide network of restaurants, flexible employee lunch programs, and more, all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. and from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
The rhetoric may be ramping up, but NPR News is focused on the facts as Election Day nears. Stay with us to get closer to the issues and closer to your vote.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU, and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Tornado watch in effect for virtually all of the KPR listening area. If you are west of Manhattan, this does not include you. If you're to the east, the odds are good. You are covered by this tornado watch till 10 p.m.
Donald Trump intends to use the United States military against American citizens.
In her closing argument for the campaign, Kamala Harris is hitting one message hard that Donald Trump poached democracy.
For Wednesday, October 30th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, an update on the toll of war in Lebanon.
We'll visit a hospital seeing a spike in burn cases from Israeli airstrikes.
We were packing our bags and getting ready to evacuate our home. My daughters were playing outside on the balcony, and then it happened.
Also, the Supreme Court allows Virginia to resume purging voter registrations.
And how a nonprofit is working to help older people living in older homes stay put.
We go in maybe for one issue, and we can identify four or five other issues that if we're not fixing then and there, will become more magnified.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. More trash talk on both sides of the presidential race today, literally. At a campaign rally in North Carolina, former President Trump called America a, quote, garbage country. NPR Stephen Fowler has more.
Republicans say Biden called Trump supporters garbage on a video call with Voto Latino Tuesday night. Biden says he was referring to the comedian who insulted Puerto Rico at a Trump rally Sunday. But Trump used the gaffe to continue his attacks on Democratic policies.
You know what? The truth is they've treated our whole country like garbage, whether they meant to or not, because they're grossly incompetent people, and they've destroyed our country.
Trump regularly uses inflammatory language in reference to illegal immigration, calling the U.S. a garbage can, a, quote, occupied country, and vowing to end what he calls an invasion of migrants. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Rocky Mount, North Carolina.
Vice President Kamala Harris will spend election night at her alma mater, Howard University. That's according to a source familiar with the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity. While Harris's home is on the West Coast, she's apparently decided to stay on the East Coast as initial results come in. Harris graduated from Howard in 1986 with a BA in political science and economics. She was a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority, which was founded at Howard. Virginia's Republican governor is welcoming the Supreme Court decision to allow the state to keep 1,600 people off voter rolls. VPM News' Jad Khalil has more.
Wednesday's ruling stemmed from a challenge to an order by Governor Glenn Youngkin that removed voters who said they were not a citizen at the DMV. Even though there's been cases of citizens being taken off the rolls, Youngkin didn't answer a question about whether he was concerned about inconveniencing them.
There may have been someone who was on the voter rolls who came off. But the reality is that they came off because they failed to identify themselves as a citizen.
Non-citizens vote in very small numbers, but it's been a centerpiece of Republican messaging in the election. Virginia voters who are mistakenly taken off need to re-register and cast a provisional ballot. They can no longer vote by mail. For NPR News, I'm Jad Khalil in Petersburg, Virginia.
America has not been building enough homes. Here's NPR's Jennifer Ludden.
Retired teacher Pat Haskins can't afford all the fixes her Maryland home has needed. Flooding basement, sagging floors, plus a ramp for her disabled husband.
I have arthritis in my back because of helping him.
She was lucky to get help from the nonprofit Rebuilding Together, where local director Chloe Bernardi says the wait list is up to a year.
We go in maybe for one issue, and we can identify four or five other issues that if we're not fixing then and there, will become more magnified.
Researchers say a housing shortage and sky-high prices leave few other options for many if they can't age in their current dwellings. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Silver Spring, Maryland.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 91 points. This is NPR. Authorities in Spain say flash flooding there has claimed the lives of at least 95 people. Emergency service workers in Valencia, Spain, saying most of the deaths occurred in the eastern region of the country, with other casualties in a nearby area. Floods of muddy water cascaded down streets. In some cases, police and rescue services had used helicopters to lift people from their homes and rubber boats to pluck motorists from the tops of their flooded cars. The river at the Amazon rainforest's largest port continues to drop to record lows due to historic drought conditions there. Researchers say they've never seen so little rainfall in the region. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports they blame the unprecedented dryness on climate change and deforestation.
Waterways throughout the Amazon have hit record lows throughout October. At last check, the water level of the Rio Negro at the port city of Manaus in Brazil had dropped to its lowest level at 12.22 meters. Earlier this month, federal authorities marked a 100-year record low at 12.66. Communities throughout the Amazon depend on the vast waterways to move everything from people to commerce in a region with few roads. This is the second year of a punishing drought being felt throughout South America. The dearth of water has affected nearly every country. Bolivia and Brazil have been fighting record wildfires, while Ecuador is rationing electricity due to a lack of water for hydropower generation. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
Crude oil futures prices rebounded after the latest data showing crude and gas inventories falling by bigger than expected amounts. Oil settled at $68.61 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from KU School of Music, inviting KU alumni to return to the 100th Annual Vespers Choir, singing alongside fellow alumni while commemorating a century of Vespers tradition on December 8th. Details at music.ku.edu.
We have a tornado watch in effect until 10 p.m. for most of the KPR listening area. It's 5:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Last night, 1 week before Election Day, Kamala Harris made her closing argument to the American people.
America, for too long, we have been consumed with too much division, chaos, and mutual distrust. And it can be easy, then, to forget a simple truth. It doesn't have to be this way.
She stood in front of the White House on the Ellipse in Washington, D.C., in the same spot where former President Donald Trump addressed his supporters before they attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. The vice president spoke for about half an hour, reviewing the agenda she'd pursue as president.
I will enact the first ever federal ban on price gouging on groceries. I'll work to lower the cost of childcare, which is out. And when Congress passes a bill to restore reproductive freedom nationwide, as President of the United States, I will proudly sign it into law.
And she drew stark contrasts between herself and Donald Trump.
And on day one, if elected, Donald Trump would walk into that office with an enemies list. When elected, I will walk in with a to-do list. Full of priorities of what I will get done for the American people.
And NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram watched the vice president's speech. Hi, Deepa.
Hey there.
Was there more to the setting than just the January 6th, 2021 symbolism?
I mean, I think part of it, Ari, was, you know, there is such a powerful statement to have Kamala Harris standing in front of the White House. And in her remarks, you know, she pointed back to the White House, literally, like she turned her back, pointed to it, and asked the people in the crowd to imagine what day one of a Trump administration would look like versus day one of a Harris administration. And she's really trying to draw this contrast of Trump having this enemies list, and that's what he would come in focusing on, versus Harris, she says, would have a to-do list of things that she wants to accomplish. It hones back to her sense of pragmatism that she is, like, kind of branding herself as in terms of a politician. You know, but I'll also say this is kind of a show of force, right? This is, according to the campaign, 75,000 people on the National Mall. It's the largest event that Harris has had in her campaign, running against someone, as we know, who is pretty focused on crowd sizes.
So it feels like there were two big planks to the speech, the Trump contrast and her own policy agenda. To start with a Trump contrast, what is her campaign's calculation here about trying to drive people away from him versus trying to drive people towards her?
Yeah, I think it's both and, right? She's doing two parts, which is one, trying to draw that contrast against Trump. And this is something that, you know, even when Biden was the nominee, that Democrats really struggled with, which is what they call Trump amnesia. It's why you have someone like Kamala Harris calling restrictions on abortion rights Trump abortion bans or Trump tax cuts for the rich. And so she really tries to emphasize Trump's role in a lot of what she says was the chaos of the years of his administration. On the other side, though, she is really consistent about reminding people at her rallies that she's not trying to run a campaign that's just against somebody or against something. She wants to bring a new generation of leadership to Washington, new ideas. And that's something she's really tried to bring into the fold, too, is say, you know, I'm not just a continuation of Joe Biden's presidency. And I'm also basically trying to run as the, you know, candidate entirely against everything Trump stands for.
So when you listen to what she included in that 30-minute speech, in contrast to Trump's speech on Sunday that was more than an hour, what were the policy proposals that you think are most notable?
Well, there's a couple that I will say get really, you know, strong reactions from the crowds that she's going to. And this is not just in Washington, of course. This is in, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and in states all over the country. So one of them is this plan to make it more affordable to take care of your parents while also taking care of your children at home. And one thing I think is really interesting about Harris is that she really likes to bring her own personal experience when she lays out some of these plans. So when she talks about the at-home care for seniors plan, you know, she talks about her own experience caring for her mom who died of cancer. And she knows what it's like to, you know, have to try and help someone, you know, find food that they can keep down. And she really tries to bring a personal lens to this.
And speaking of plans, abortion has been front and center for Democrats ever since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. Is that still kind of the leading talking point for the Harris campaign in this final week?
It's a huge one. I mean, keep in mind, this is the issue that really, you know, Harris took the lead on as vice president, and that certainly carried into her campaign for president here. And it's something that really fires up a lot of voters still, and particularly, like we had talked about earlier, some of those Republican voters, some of those independent voters who maybe, particularly women, who have maybe never voted for a Democrat before, but are really considering it this time in this election to cast their ballot for Harris. And we'll see where it kind of falls into play in these last 7 days.
And let's note that while Democrats are focusing on Harris's speech today, Republicans are focusing on something that President Biden said on a call with Latino voters shortly before she spoke.
The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. His demonization of Latinos is unconscionable, and it's un-American.
Deepa, how is this playing out?
I mean, this isn't exactly on message for the Harris campaign, right? And Republicans, Trump, they're already using this clip to criticize Biden and Democrats. The White House did weigh in, and Biden posted on X trying to clarify his remarks from last night. He said he was referring to the comedian who made the remarks calling Puerto Rico garbage, and he was calling that rhetoric garbage, not Trump's supporters. But, you know, this really undercuts Harris's message at a time when she's only got a few days left here to convince Republican voters, independent voters, to cast their ballot for her. And today, as she headed out to North Carolina, Harris distanced herself from those comments. She said she strongly disagrees with any criticism of people based on who they vote for.
NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go overseas now. More than 12,000 people in Lebanon have been injured by Israeli airstrikes. Now, those injuries commonly include burns. And the most severe cases end up in one particular hospital in Beirut. NPR's Arzu Rezvani takes us there. And a warning, this piece describes the toll Israel's war in Lebanon is taking on civilians, especially children.
There are no more beds available at the Jaitawi Hospital's burn center.
Every day we have several calls from the hospitals
to transfer patients, but we cannot, of course, we cannot accept everybody because of the big flow of patients.
That's Dr. Ziad Suleiman. He's been a plastic and reconstructive surgeon here for the last 20 years, and he's never seen this wing of the hospital under so much strain.
What we have done, we have transferred staff from other wards to the burn units, and we are training staff about the burn and the trauma and complicated wounds, fractures, so it's complicated.
These severe burn cases Dr. Suleiman and his team are treating are from Israeli airstrikes. They started last year. After Hamas carried out its October 7th attack on Israel, Hezbollah started firing rockets from Lebanon in a show of solidarity. A low-grade conflict ensued, and then, last month, it turned into a full-fledged war. Israel killed Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah, sent ground troops into Lebanon, and expanded its airstrikes. Several high-ranking Hezbollah officials have been killed, but it's come at a huge cost.
This is Ivana.
Ivana Likbiri is the youngest patient in this burn unit. She's 18 months old and wrapped in bandages from head to toe. There's only enough room for a pink little pacifier. Her mother, Fatima, is at her bedside. She recounts the day her village, Deir Qanun Annar, was attacked.
We were packing our bags and getting ready to evacuate our home, and we thought we'd have time for a quick breakfast first. My daughters were playing outside on the balcony, and then it happened.
In a flash, the wood terrace the two little girls were playing on went up in flames.
I don't know what divine strength filled me, but I grabbed my girls from the fire and threw them over the balcony to save them.
Fatima now splits her time between two different hospitals where her daughters are getting treated for severe burns. There weren't enough beds for both girls to stay together. On this day, Fatima is at the bedside of little Ivana. Tomorrow, she'll swap places with her husband and visit 7-year-old Raha, who often asks if they'll ever return home and worries they'll end up on the streets.
This generation now knows war. My 7-year-old sees Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on the television and says, "Mom, is this the man that is killing us? Will the Israelis come and kill us?"
Fatima says she doesn't know why her village was attacked. Israel claims it struck 1,600 Hezbollah targets across southern Lebanon in airstrikes that killed more than 500 people that day. How many were Hezbollah fighters is not clear. NPR asked the Israeli military why Fatima's village was hit. It said airstrikes can bring on, quote, secondary explosions, indicating the presence of munitions, rockets, and lethal missiles. This is what makes this war so cruel, so painful. Fighters and civilians, young and old, their fate is often intertwined. It's one that little Ivana narrowly escaped, badly wounded. Many of her first words are now just whimpers. Her mother tries to cheer her up, waving a doll the hospital got her. But the pain medication is starting to wear off. The road ahead for the Likbiri family is uncertain, but one thing is for sure, says Fatima. They will never return to the village they fled from, not even after the war ends. All the good memories of their life there, they're all gone. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Beirut.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Did you know that listeners are more apt to frequent businesses that support their local public radio station? Well, if you run a business, you can harness that passion for public radio by becoming a KPR sponsor. Learn more at sponsorship.kansaspublicradio.org.
K KPR is Kansas Public Radio, broadcasting at 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.9 FM in Atchison, 90.3 FM in Chanute, lots of other frequencies throughout the KPR listening area, most of which are covered by a tornado watch until 10 o'clock tonight. Allen, Anderson, Atchison, Coffey, Donovan, Douglas, Franklin, Greenwood, Jackson, Jefferson, Johnson, Leavenworth, Lynn, Lyon, Miami, Morris, Neosho, Osage, Shawnee, Waubonsie, Wilson, Woodsonham, Wyandotte counties in Kansas, Andrew, Bates, Buchanan, Clay, Holt, Jackson, Nottoway, Platte, and Ray counties in Missouri. If you are a dedicated student of geography and or attended a Kansas middle school, you may recognize all of these particular counties as being the homes of, say, Topeka, Lawrence, the Kansas City Metro, Chanute, Atchison, Olathe, Overland Park. Covers a huge swath of the KPR listening area. Tornado watch until 10 o'clock tonight. Tornado watch until 9 o'clock tonight for Chase County.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas Libraries, commemorating 100 years of Watson Library as a cornerstone of the KU campus and community. Learn about the Watson Centennial at lib.ku.edu/Watson100.
77 degrees in Lawrence, 76 in Topeka, 55 in Manhattan now that the front has moved through. The time is 5:20.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Today, just 6 days before the election, the Supreme Court made a ruling allowing Virginia to continue purging individuals from state voter rolls. The state says it's removing ineligible non-citizens, but NPR's Jude Joffe Block has spoken to U.S. citizen voters whose registrations were also canceled as part of the state's program. She joins us now. Hi, Jude.
Hi there.
Hi. Okay, so clarify for us what Virginia was doing and what the Supreme Court did today.
Well, yeah, well, states have a responsibility to clean up their voter rolls. And the key issue is they have to take care to not remove eligible citizens when they do that. Mm-hmm. And they also have to be mindful of when that's happening. Virginia has an ongoing program that's been continuing to remove people from the rolls who they believe are non-citizens based on documents they filed or forms they filled out at the DMV. But we've talked to some U.S. citizens, as you mentioned, who mistakenly were ensnared in this because one reason is those DMV forms can be confusing. So last Friday, a federal judge said Virginia was systematically removing voters too close to the election in violation of federal law. And the judge said Virginia had to stop and had to restore 1,600 voters back on the rolls who'd been removed since August. And then Virginia appealed up to the Supreme Court, which this morning blocked that lower court ruling from taking effect. And that allows Virginia to keep removing people from the rolls.
Got it. Okay, so Virginia can keep removing people from the rolls. But you spoke to U.S. citizens who have been affected by this, right? Like, what does this ruling mean for them?
Well, this is a really important point because Virginia does allow people to register in person all the way through Election Day. So that means that if anyone is eligible to vote who was mistakenly taken off the rolls, they can still vote. And this is Ryan Snow. He's an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law.
They should feel confident in going down either, you know, during early voting through Saturday or on Tuesday on Election Day and fill out the same day registration form and cast their provisional ballot, and that ballot will be counted.
He said his organization and others are going to be monitoring that. And, you know, we spoke with a U.S. citizen in Lynchburg, Virginia, Nadra Wilson, and she was removed from the voter rolls as part of this program. And she was able to re-register, and she told me yesterday that she voted early.
Good. Okay, well, Jude, I know that you've done a lot of reporting about claims that non-citizens could vote illegally in this election. How does what's happening in Virginia tie into that?
Well, yeah, this narrative about non-citizens voting in large numbers, it's not backed by evidence, but it is being promoted by former President Trump and his allies. And a lot of election lawyers are concerned this is being used to sow doubt in the election. It could even potentially be used to challenge results. And we've also seen this narrative prompting policy. So Republican states like Virginia have been taking actions in the name of removing non-citizens, but these actions are sweeping up U.S. citizens. It happened in Alabama as well, where the state wound up acknowledging in court that its program to remove non-citizens mistakenly flagged more than 2,000 eligible voters. So voting rights groups are extremely concerned about this, and they strongly disagree with the Supreme Court action today.
Well, this decision from the Supreme Court comes less than a week from Election Day. What do legal experts say about the timing of all of this?
Yeah, well, so there's no written decision from the Supreme Court, so it's a little bit murky how to even interpret it. But I spoke with University of Baltimore law professor Kim Whaley. She said given that this was happening on the shadow docket and that two lower courts had already ruled against Virginia, that it's hard not to see this action by the Supreme Court as political and ideological. And I also spoke with Nate Persley. He's an election law expert at Stanford Law School. He said he was somewhat surprised. He says the fact that the court got involved on a case like this at the last minute means they don't plan to be sitting on the sidelines. It shows they're willing to be involved in some of the minutia of running an election. Mm-hmm. And we know a lot of litigation is headed their way this election season.
That is NPR's Jude Joffe-Block. Thank you so much, Jude.
Thank you.
The U.S. has not built enough new homes for years. That means millions of people are living in places that are just old and falling into disrepair. Many of these people are seniors struggling to stay put as they age. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on what that looks like for one couple.
Pat Haskins' red brick home in Silver Spring, Maryland, is about as old as she is, 72. There are family photos everywhere and walls painted her favorite color.
Purple, purple, purple.
Purple, just like her toenails and slide-on sandals. Pat bought the house 2 decades ago, but living here has gotten harder as her partner James has suffered from diabetes.
James has one leg, and he's blind, and he has kidney failure.
Sitting outside on their steps, Pat shows how, for years, they struggled together to get him into the house.
So he would sit down and just go one by one with his butt.
Hauling himself up one step at a time while Pat grabbed under his arms to pull him up.
That's why I have arthritis in my back, you know, because of helping him.
They desperately needed a wheelchair ramp. Plus, the basement had started flooding when it rained. But like so many in older, cheaper housing, Pat could not afford those fixes. She'd been an elementary school science teacher with a small pension, but
I took my $30,000 out and I put my daughter through college. I don't regret it, but if I had kept the money, I wouldn't need the help that I need.
She's gotten help from a national nonprofit called Rebuilding Together, which makes repairs people need to stay put, especially seniors.
We are seeing it increase in terms of the need, but also the issues are becoming more significant.
Chloe Bernardi heads the group's local chapter in Montgomery County, Maryland.
We go in maybe for one issue, and we can identify 4 or 5 other issues that if we're not fixing then and there, will become more magnified.
One older couple living with a son and grandchildren spent a year with a hole in the roof catching rain in buckets. And she says letting problems go gets expensive.
We had replaced last year a HVAC system for a woman who's 100 living with one of her relatives but didn't have heat, so it was running off oil, so her bill was $700-$800 a month.
Last year, she says requests for help shot up 400%. Nationally, most repair programs like this are underfunded with years-long wait lists. Todd Swanstrom with the University of Missouri-St. Louis says thousands of homes are lost to disrepair, making the affordable housing shortage worse. But it's a crisis that's often invisible.
We don't see the black mold inside the house that gives a kid asthma, or the fact that inadequate air conditioning means an elderly couple suffering from heat stroke.
Last year, Pat Haskins got a wheelchair ramp and a fix for her basement flooding.
I would come down the steps, and before I could get to the bottom step, it would come like up past my ankle.
The group Rebuilding Together patched a hole in the basement and directed water away from the outside stairwell where it had been gushing in.
You want a pillow under your head?
She checks on James in the bedroom.
You just want to lay right here.
Yeah.
Pat doesn't know where they'd go if they had to leave. Even though plenty more things need fixing, her only plan is to stay here forever. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Silver Spring, Maryland.
And that report was produced by NPR's Marisa Pignolosa.
This is NPR News.
4 years ago, a near riot broke out at a polling center in Detroit, Michigan.
I heard banging on the windows. I heard chanting, "Stop the count, stop the count." It was a hairy moment.
How poll workers in the city are preparing for this year's election. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR station's Morning Edition. From 5 to 9 a.m., Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello. Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu.
Stay tuned. News headlines coming right up. I will have an overview of the weather situation, sort of like the atmosphere is reloading right now. We'll tell you what to expect here in the next few hours. It is 5:30.
All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Coming up, voters in the Pacific Northwest have leaned reliably blue for decades.
At the top of the ticket, down ballot, different story.
This race is going to be close, within the margin of error. Don't think for 1 minute it's not going to come down to just a few thousand votes that are going to separate us.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Vice President Kamala Harris is weighing in on the controversy surrounding President Biden's response to racist and otherwise offensive remarks at a recent Trump rally in New York City. NPR's Mara Liasson has the story.
President Biden caused confusion and controversy when he reacted to comments a surrogate for Trump made, calling Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage. Biden said, quote, "The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters, his demonization of Latinos." Biden clarified later he was referring to hateful rhetoric from a Trump surrogate who made the disparaging remarks at Trump's Madison Square Garden rally on Sunday. The Trump campaign says Biden was referring to all of Trump's supporters. Vice President Harris was asked about the president's comments.
I strongly disagree with any criticism of people based on who they vote for.
Polls show Harris and Trump are virtually tied in the last week before Election Day. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
A report in the medical journal The Lancet finds that climate change is harming people's health more than ever. That report comes just ahead of next month's international climate negotiations, as NPR's Alejandra Barunda reports.
Climate-worsened disasters like Hurricane Helene and intense summer heat waves are actively hurting people's health and sometimes even killing them. That's a key finding of this year's Lancet Countdown. Marina Romanello is a researcher at University College London and the director of the annual report.
And what we're seeing is that people all around the world, in every country, are already facing record-breaking threats to their well-being, to their health, and to their survival from the rapidly changing climates.
There are some bright spots in this year's report, too. A growing number of countries have now at least assessed their health system's vulnerability to climate change. But Romanello says almost no countries are doing enough to stop the root cause of the problem.
This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. I want to turn first to the weather. We don't have any active warnings right at this moment. We do expect that to change here in the not-too-distant future. We currently have a tornado watch in effect. Again, that means that all of the conditions are good for the development of tornadoes. Severe thunderstorms are sort of lumped in with that. We're talking about an unstable atmosphere, lots and lots of moisture, lots and lots of energy in the atmosphere as well. So we want to be on the lookout for tornadoes. There are none actively moving through the area right now, but we're worried that there could be. So we have a tornado watch until 9 o'clock tonight for Chase County. The much larger area covered by KPR that is under a tornado watch includes the following counties: Allen, Anderson, Atchison, Coffee, Donovan, Douglas, Franklin, Greenwood, Jackson, Jefferson, Johnson, Leavenworth, Lynn, Lyon, Miami, Morris, Neosho, Osage, Shawnee, Wabansee, Wilson, Woodson, and Wyandotte counties in Kansas, Andrew, Bates, Buchanan, Clay, Holt, Jackson, Nottoway, Platte, and Ray counties in Missouri. That tornado watch is in effect until 10 o'clock tonight, and that covers most of the KPR listening area. It includes the cities of Topeka, Emporia, Lawrence, all of the Kansas City metro, Chanute, Atchison. So be weather aware. Make sure you have multiple ways to get warnings and information about other watches that's issued tonight. We're particularly concerned about this severe weather coming through after sunset. It's very difficult to see tornadoes. You definitely want to have multiple ways to hear if a tornado warning is issued. But a tornado watch until 10 o'clock for most of the KPR listening area. Stay tuned to KPR through the night, and we will tell you more once we know more. In other news, Kansas election officials say they have seen voters confused about the rules around promoting candidates at polling places. That's also known as electioneering. Kate Mays filed this report.
Kansas laws prohibit voters from wearing or distributing anything displaying a candidate's name within 250 feet of a polling location entrance. Johnson County Election Commissioner Fred Sherman says that he interprets that rule literally.
They cannot wear a hat or an item or a button in there if it has the candidate's name on them. Where it gets a little murky and kind of confusing is where there may be a slogan or symbols, like whether it's a cat shirt or a mega hat.
Missouri law also bans electioneering and is even stricter about what clothing you can wear to the polls. In both states, electioneering is a crime punishable by a fine or jail time. I'm Kate Mace.
You'll find more news headlines at our website, kansaspublicradio.org. It is 77 degrees in Lawrence. It is 5:35.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Just in time for Halloween, the Commerce Department is out with a new report card on the U.S. economy. And it's got more treats than tricks. The report shows the economy grew at a healthy clip in July, August, and September. The ghosts of a feared recession have largely disappeared, and the American consumer is performing like a costumed superhero. NPR's Scott Horsley wrote that intro and has this report.
The U.S. economy has some good bones. Just look at all the Halloween decorations haunting front yards all over the country.
Skeletons are really hot. Spiders are hot. Cobwebs are really hot.
Nothing says discretionary spending like a $39 webcaster gun that shoots glow-in-the-dark cobwebs, like a hot glue gun on steroids. That's just one of the items you can find at David Mangelson's Halloween Crafts Superstore in Omaha, Nebraska.
My folks started it, and I was 11 years old when we opened the store. Family run and selling fun.
This year, Americans will spend nearly $12 billion on candy, costumes, and other trick-or-treat accessories. And while some of us wait till the last minute, Mangelson says the hardcore Halloweeners have been getting ready since summer, adding to the Commerce Department's third quarter sales tally.
They're thinking about it all year round, and they keep collecting this stuff. They just run out of places to store it.
So before all those skeletons go back in the closet, let's review the economic report card. The nation's gross domestic product grew at an annual rate of 2.8% in the third quarter, and consumer spending, the telltale heart of this economy, beat even faster. Americans increased their spending on cars, restaurant meals, and vacations during the quarter. Chief Economist Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics says what's fueling all that spending is the healthy labor market.
Everyone's got a job. And, you know, just as long as people have a job and their wages are rising at a pace that's greater than the rate of inflation, that's the basis for continued strong spending, and that's what we're getting.
Business investment was also up during the quarter, as was spending by the federal government. One of the few weak spots in the GDP report was housing. Sales of existing homes and new construction have both been in a slump, weighed down by high mortgage rates. Still, Zandi says the overall economy in the U.S. is outperforming those in most other countries around the world.
The U.S. is leading the way, and actually, you know, I travel a lot all over the world and talking to different business leaders and government officials, they marvel at our economy and how well it's performing
and they wish they had some of our mojo.
Throughout the Biden-Harris administration, annual economic growth has averaged 3.2%, stronger than the Trump administration enjoyed even before the pandemic. Still, polls suggest many Americans are dissatisfied with the economy. While inflation has come down significantly in the last 2 years, people are still frustrated by the cumulative price hikes during the pandemic recovery. With less than a week to go before the presidential election, there are some signs people's attitudes about the economy are improving. Consumer confidence, as measured by the Conference Board, just notched its biggest monthly increase in 3.5 years. Dana Peterson, who's chief economist of the Conference Board, says people are feeling somewhat better about how the economy's doing now and where they think it's going in the future.
People see the economy through these partisan lenses, but the data are telling us that the economy is doing well enough. Now, that could change once we do have the election, and depending upon what the results are, we could see some implications for consumer confidence. But at least leading up to the election, we're not seeing people holding back on spending or anything like that.
At Mangelson Superstore in Omaha, that economic engine shows no sign of slowing. As soon as the sugar high of Halloween wears off, it'll be time to start prepping for Christmas. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
In the last election, voters in the Pacific Northwest sent 3 freshman Latina members to Congress, and they are not all from one party. The region is often presumed to offer easy wins for Democrats, but down-ballot races are actually a much stronger shade of purple. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Griselis has more.
If you look at a typical political map of the United States, Oregon and Washington look safely blue. Neither state has voted for a Republican for president since 1984. But Oregon Congresswoman Andrea Salinas, a Democrat, says it's a different story. Ballot.
We're all feeling like we're scraping tooth and nail to get ahead.
That's the freshman member on the campaign trail. She represents the state's largest concentration of Latino residents. And her 6th congressional district is one of the closest races in the country. And she's fighting for resources to keep her seat.
We are not a battleground state, and so when you have a presidential election happening, the battleground states really get the most attention.
She's not alone. She's also part of an Oregon duo who made history as the first Latina members to represent their state in Congress.
LCD! LCD!
Next door at a hyped-up rally in the state's 5th congressional district, Republican Congresswoman Lori Chavez de Remer is facing nearly identical dynamics, and she has a grave warning for supporters.
This race is going to be close, within the margin of error. Don't think for one minute it's not going to come down to just a few thousand votes that are going to separate us.
She flipped her district red in 2022, making it a key target for Republicans' efforts to keep control of the House. She's facing off against a popular Democratic state lawmaker who wants to flip the district back. But Chavez de Remer tells NPR she's used her time in Congress to deliver money and jobs to this district.
Yeah, it's important for Oregonians, so they're going to get out and vote. I'm looking forward to visiting with everybody, and we're going to win this thing.
She also has a major ally backing her at this Oregon City rally, House Speaker Mike Johnson, who's made multiple visits here.
The most important races where I am is reserved for the end of the cycle.
Another one of those Johnson stops comes an hour north in Washington's 3rd congressional district, where a similar dynamic is at play. It's represented by another Latina freshman incumbent, but she's a Democrat that Johnson hopes is ousted by a Republican opponent. Democrat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez staged one of the House's biggest flips in the last election cycle in deep Republican country near Vancouver.
This seat was drawn to be a red seat.
That's Glusenkamp-Perez during a stop on her RV tour. Her contested seat in Southwest Washington shares another trend in this area, a district closely divided along urban and rural lines. Her Republican opponent, retired Army Green Beret Joe Kent, says the party is on track to get the district back with help from having former President Donald Trump on the ticket.
The Republican Party here learned a lot of hard lessons in 2022.
That's Kent at a recent candidate forum. He says Republicans have presented a unified front.
If we spend an exorbitant amount of time and money destroying each other, that can cost us.
For her part, Glusenkamp-Perez has kept her own party at arm's length, issuing early warnings about President Biden's failed re-election bid and avoiding endorsement talk on Vice President Harris. She argues too often national politics eclipses local needs in her district, a common refrain here.
In rural communities, we have felt really frustrated about how much oxygen these national races get, and it feels like it's at the expense of the local issues.
These three members of Congress say party loyalty is not the way to win in their districts. It comes down to individual candidates breaking through to voters on local issues and connecting on identity. Claudia Rizales, NPR News, the Pacific Northwest.
This is NPR News. Right now, IV fluids are in short supply after Hurricane Helene hit a key factory. But drug shortages have been a problem for years. Hurricane or no hurricane, common cheap drugs that hospitals rely on are just sometimes unavailable. Sally Helm from NPR's Planet Money podcast explains the economics behind these shortages.
Jared Sibbett is a flight nurse in the Mountain West. He transports patients via helicopter or airplane.
Well, I mean, it's unpredictable, I guess. You could get somebody who fell off a cliff and broke their leg. You could get a bear mauling. So it keeps me on my toes.
Jared spoke to us without clearance from his higher-ups, so we're leaving the name of his hospital out. And he's noticed this problem, drug shortages. Common generic drugs that he uses every day sometimes run out. This is a problem at hospitals all over the country, even for basic things like dextrose and saline, basically salt water and sugar water. These shortages are bad for patients.
The simpler the drug is, the more upsetting the feeling is. This problem is a solvable problem in a free market, so could we please just fix that already?
I set out to understand these shortages, and early on, I found a helpful guide.
I have been looking at these issues since 2011.
That's Marta Voshinska. She's a healthcare economist and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She says most drugs that get hit by shortages are in a particular category. They're injectable drugs mostly administered in hospitals. And often the immediate cause of a shortage is a manufacturing problem. These injectable drugs have to be sterile. We don't want to inject unsafe things like bacteria straight into our veins.
It could also be metal shavings or glass particles. You do not want to have these contaminants in these products, right?
Marta says if something does go wrong at a factory, it might have to shut down for a bit. And boom, shortage. Many of these drugs have few manufacturers. They're generics, not under patent. Anyone can make them. And for drug makers, they're not all that profitable. They sell for a pretty low price.
There is this tremendous price pressure, and some of those life-saving drugs are costing us less than a cup of coffee.
And now we're at the heart of the economic mystery. Because if prices are too low, so low that we're getting shortages, why don't manufacturers just raise the price more? One possible reason? A lot of hospitals have pooled their buying power, negotiating as a group. That can drive prices down. There are also some rules that make it hard for manufacturers to raise prices too much. They're meant to keep healthcare costs down for patients and hospitals.
What are the good reasons to set things up to bring costs down?
What are the good reasons? We spend a lot of money on healthcare, and I don't even know how sort of to talk about this.
But Marta says the system we have now is missing something, a greater focus on supply chain resilience. Shortages would happen less often if manufacturers had a spare factory or a backup supplier. But to get that to happen, hospitals may need to pay more for these drugs.
We need to incentivize hospitals to pay attention to which manufacturers are reliable and put much more weight on that rather than just price.
Marta imagines a way to reward hospitals for taking proactive steps to prevent shortages, like by working with a higher quality manufacturer. Then that manufacturer could charge a higher price. It's a solution geared towards that supply chain resilience, which has value, especially to patients. But it's been hard to get anyone in this system to pay for it. Sally Helm, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion. Over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Morning Edition from NPR News brings you reporting from around the world.
NPR's Carrie Kahn is covering all this from the Venezuelan city of Caracas.
And we also realize there's plenty to learn at home, literally.
Here's my compost bin in the freezer. We've got some tomato bits, and now we're adding 2 tea bags.
Listen for the latest headlines plus useful life hacks every weekday on Morning Edition.
Join us tomorrow morning. Morning Edition comes your way 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations. Jay Schaefer will be your local host. From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, also at 90.3 FM in Chanute, 91.3 FM in Junction City. Always online, we are streaming at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from I2S at KU, creating, disseminating, and commercializing fundamental knowledge and new technologies in computer systems, communication systems, and radar systems. More at i2s-research.ku.edu.
In our next half hour, an update of news headlines. We will continue to bring you breaking news about weather. If any warnings or other watches are issued, we'll let you know about that. Also, as November 5th is approaching, local election officials are contending with an absolute fire hose of misinformation.
It's difficult because we can't possibly have eyes on every platform and see what everything is being posted.
All of this as former President Donald Trump continues to call into question the integrity of the vote. We will talk about it coming up on KPR. We do have a tornado watch till 9 o'clock tonight for Chase County. Much of the rest of the KPR listening area, including Lawrence, Topeka, Emporia, the Kansas City Metro, and Chanute, covered by a tornado watch till 10 o'clock tonight. Stay tuned to KPR throughout the evening. It's 10 minutes before 6.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. War is always a disaster for civilians. What makes it even worse is when combatants flagrantly violate the laws and norms intended to shield civilians from the worst abuses. NPR's Greg Myrie has been covering 2 wars where many of those rules are being broken, the Russia-Ukraine fight and the Israel-Hamas battle.
I'm at the main children's hospital in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, which is still scarred from a direct hit by a deadly Russian missile this summer. Flowers and stuffed animals are piled at the front gate. Repair work is ongoing at several damaged buildings. This is one of the most notorious Russian attacks on civilians, but there are many more.
We documented more than 78,000 episodes of war crimes.
Oleksandr Matvichuk leads the Center for Civil Liberties. The Ukrainian group won the Nobel Peace Prize 2 years ago for its work in compiling Russian abuses.
I personally interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people who were beaten, raped, their fingers were cut, their nails were drilled. There were electrical shocks.
The group works from a modest Soviet-era apartment building in the center of Kyiv, just a couple of miles from the children's hospital.
Probably in the most documented war in the human history. It's because we have now digital instruments which provides human rights groups an opportunity to collect evidence and to identify perpetrators.
The big challenge, she says, is turning this mountain of evidence into a workable international system that holds those perpetrators responsible. The Geneva Conventions established the fundamental laws of war in the wake of World War II, and they mark their 75th anniversary in August.
The Geneva Conventions created this basic idea that civilians really should be insulated from the worst harms of war.
Ona Hathaway is a professor at Yale Law School who often writes on the rules of war. She says several current wars are eroding decades of work to prevent or at least limit abuses.
You can't help but look around the world and not worry that these basic innovations and accomplishments of the post-war era are being undermined. We're seeing civilians being not just killed in war, but it appears being targeted in war.
Take Gaza, where Israeli military operations have killed more than 43,000 Palestinians, a majority of them women and children, according to Palestinian officials. Sari Bashi is a head of global research for Human Rights Watch.
The Israeli military's disregard for civilian protections has deteriorated dramatically in the last 20 years. They are authorizing just massive bombings with very heavy bombs in urban areas where you know you will kill hundreds of children.
Bashi is based in the West Bank and is sharply critical of the ways Israel and Hamas are conducting the war.
Hamas-led groups were able to kill more than 800 Israeli civilians on October 7th because it was planned at the top and executed downward. And that's why Human Rights Watch has called those attacks a crime against humanity.
Hamas, designated a terrorist group by Israel in the West, says its attacks are in pursuit of Palestinian rights. Israel says it's not targeting civilians, but faces Hamas fighters using Palestinian civilians as human shields. Ona Hathaway says these scenarios, where a state military is fighting a non-state group, complicates humanitarian efforts.
What we're seeing is a real change in the nature of warfare, and these non-state actor groups have tried to, frankly, take advantage of the rules by sometimes using them to shield themselves from violence, and so placing themselves in or near schools or hospitals.
For example, a state army, like Israel, has repeatedly attacked...
We interrupt this broadcast of All Things Considered to bring you a tornado warning that has been issued by the National Weather Service. This tornado warning, that means a tornado is located on the ground. Radar has indicated this tornado warning for northeastern Atchison County, northwestern Buchanan County, northwestern Platte County. This is in effect until 6:15. Just about 4 minutes ago, a severe thunderstorm capable of producing a tornado was located near Atchison. It is moving to the east at 35 miles per hour. Again, this has been indicated on radar. We don't yet have on-the-ground confirmation, but better safe than sorry. Flying debris could be dangerous to those caught without shelter. If you are in Atchison, Rushville, Lewis and Clark Village, be aware, a tornado warning is in effect for you until 6:15. Take cover now. Move to a basement or an interior room on the lowest floor of a sturdy building. Avoid windows. If you are outdoors or in a mobile home or in a vehicle, you need to move to the closest substantial shelter and protect yourself from flying debris. This cluster of thunderstorms is capable of producing tornadoes and widespread significant wind damage. Do not wait to see this tornado. Do not wait to hear this tornado. You need to take cover now if you are in Atchison, Rushville, or Lewis and Clark Village. A tornado warning is in effect for you until 6:15. I am going to check back with the National Weather Service, see if we have on-the-ground confirmation, sightline confirmation yet. But don't wait to get that. Don't wait to see the tornado. Don't wait to hear the tornado. If you are in northeastern Atchison County, southwestern Buchanan County, or northwestern Platte County, take cover now. A tornado warning is in effect for you until 6:15. Again, that is a tornado warning for the city of Atchison, Rushville, and Lewis and Clark Village. A tornado warning in effect until 6:15 for Atchison, Buchanan, and Platte counties. Again, I am going to check back in with the National Weather Service, and we'll be back in just a moment. But if you are in Atchison, Buchanan, or Platte counties, take cover now. A tornado warning is in effect for you until 6:15. I'll be right back.
Released an album of the same name in 1997, it was an unlikely smash, as NPR once put it. The album catapulted them to worldwide acclaim, ultimately earned them a Grammy.
Particularly notable was Mirabal's trumpet solos.
Years later, Mirabal released his debut solo album, the Latin Grammy-nominated Buena Vista Social Club Presents Manuel Guajiro Mirabal.
In a radio interview in 2000, Mirabal spoke about his relationship with his trumpet. He said he always had it with him, taking it apart, cleaning it, and caring for it. Mirabal saying his wife and he joke that the trumpet is his first love, she's his second.
This is Laura Lorson for Kansas Public Radio, interrupting our broadcast of All Things Considered with some urgent weather news. A tornado warning has been issued for northeastern Atchison County, southwestern Buchanan County, northwestern Platte County until 6:15. This is a radar-indicated tornado, but do not wait to see it for yourself. Do not go outside, try to take a picture of it. Do not wait to hear it. If you are in the city of Atchison or in Rushville or Lewis and Clark Village, you need to be taking shelter now. You need to get as many walls between yourself and the outside as possible. A basement is best, but if you don't have that available, an interior room on the lowest floor of a sturdy building is a good option. You need to avoid windows. If you are outdoors, you need to get indoors. If you are in a mobile home, it will not protect you from a tornado. If you are in a vehicle, it will not protect you from a tornado. You need to move to the closest substantial shelter you can find and protect yourself from flying debris. Oftentimes, city buildings will be open, a city hall. Churches often open up for shelter. If you are in Atchison or in Rushville or Lewis and Clark Village, you need to get yourself inside sturdy shelter now. A tornado warning has been issued for northeastern Atchison, southwestern Buchanan, or northwestern Platte County. If you are taking shelter right now in portions of Atchison County, Buchanan County, or Platte County, a couple of things you need to make sure you do. Be sure you have shoes on if there is damage. This will be very dangerous. And when I say shoes, I don't mean flip-flops. I don't mean slippers. I mean good, sturdy shoes. If you are in this area and waiting for it to move through your region, cover yourself, protect your head, use pillows. You could conceivably, if you don't have any other option, get into a bathtub, cover yourself with a mattress. Some kind of twin size mattress would really work well here. You could get inside a closet. Again, you're trying to put as many walls between yourself and the outside as you possibly can. Again, we have a tornado warning for northeastern Atchison County, southwestern Buchanan County, and northwestern Platte County. This is in effect until 6:15. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and on Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, K210CR in Atchison 89.9, and K258BT Manhattan at 99.5. We're also streaming at kansaspublicradio.org. Once again, we do still have tornado watches in effect throughout the KPR listening area until 10 o'clock tonight, but right now a tornado warning is active for northeastern Atchison County, including the city of Atchison, southwestern Buchanan County, and northwestern Platte County until 6:15. Here's the NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. As the clock ticks down to Election Day, campaigning by the respective presidential candidates is ramping up. Vice President Kamala Harris made her pitch in Raleigh, North Carolina today before moving on to Harrisburg in the critical swing state of Pennsylvania.
So I'm visiting with you this afternoon because we need you to vote, Pennsylvania. We need you to vote. Because we have just 6 days left in one of the most consequential elections of our lifetime.
Harris wraps up her campaign day in Madison, Wisconsin. As for her rival, former President Donald Trump, also was in North Carolina today and is in Green Bay, Wisconsin tonight. We'll be joined by retired NFL quarterback Brett Favre. Digital ad campaign backed by billionaire Elon Musk is pushing messages that are intended to look like they're from Vice President Harris. As NPR's Bobby Allen explains, the ads make false claims about Harris.
A series of political ads appearing on Facebook falsely say Kamala Harris wants to institute a mandatory gun buyback program and make it easier for undocumented immigrants to receive a driver's license. They are from a group called Building America's Future, a pro-Trump outfit funded by Elon Musk. But they look like they're from the Harris campaign. Musk has spent more than $100 million bankrolling a Trump campaign field operation. He appears at Trump rallies, and he's expected to have a role in the White House if Trump is elected. The billionaire has also turned his social media platform X into a powerful pro-Trump machine, where he has been amplifying misleading information about the integrity of the U.S. voting system. The Washington Post recently called Musk A Human October Surprise. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Negotiations have resumed between Boeing and its striking machinists union. NPR's Joel Rose reports the sides were back at the bargaining table yesterday, with the strike in its seventh week.
The machinists union, representing some 33,000 striking workers, said it had a, quote, productive face-to-face meeting with Boeing. The union said those talks were held with the assistance of Acting Secretary of Labor Julie Hsu. The work stoppage has crippled production at Boeing's airplane factories in the Pacific Northwest for more than 7 weeks. The financial impact on the company and its suppliers is mounting, although Boeing announced this week that it will raise billions of dollars by selling stock and other securities to shore up its balance sheet. The two sides have gotten closer on wages, but key issues, including retirement benefits, remain. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
In this last week before the election, the economy is very much in focus. New numbers out today showing the economy growing at a healthy 2.8% annual rate for the 3 months ending in September. While down slightly from the previous month, the gross domestic product, which measures the total output of goods and services within U.S. borders, largely appears to be holding up. Those numbers driven by still strong spending by consumers. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 91 points. This is NPR.
You are listening to NPR on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Laura Lorson. We do have some urgent breaking weather at this point in the KPR listening area. We are still following a tornado warning. That means a tornado is on the ground. This has been indicated by radar. A tornado warning for northeastern Atchison County, southwestern Buchanan County, and northwestern Platte County. This is in effect for about another 10 minutes until 6:15. If you are in Atchison or in Rushville, Lewis and Clark Village, you should be in your shelter now. Flying debris will be dangerous to anyone caught without shelter. Mobile homes could be damaged or destroyed. Damage to roofs, windows, and vehicles will occur. Tree damage is likely. You cannot outrun a tornado. You cannot ride a tornado out in a mobile home. You need to get to sturdy shelter. If you are in the city of Atchison, if you're in the town of Rushville, if you are in Lewis and Clark Village, you should be taking shelter right now. Move to a basement or an interior room on the lowest floor of a sturdy building. Avoid windows. Debris is a huge danger. Things will be flying through the air. Windows break. Stay away from them. If you are outdoors or in a mobile home or in a vehicle, you need to get into a substantial shelter, a sturdy building, and protect yourself from flying debris. Again, this tornado warning for Atchison, Rushville, Lewis and Clark Village. This covers portions of Atchison County, Buchanan County, and Platte County. Is in effect until 6:15 this evening. The National Weather Service has also issued a severe thunderstorm warning in that general area on top of that tornado warning. This is for southeastern Doniphan County, northwestern Leavenworth County, eastern Atchison County, southwestern Buchanan County, and northwestern Platte County. This storm, located near Nortonville, about 11 miles southwest of Atchison, 60-mile-an-hour wind gust, quarter-sized hail. If you are in Atchison, Wathena, Dearborn, Camden Point, Rushville, Lewis and Clark Village, Doniphan, DeKalb, Iatan, Bean Lake, Cummings, or Potter, be aware this severe thunderstorm warning is for you. It is in effect until 6:30 this evening. This does include Interstate 29 between mile markers 26 and 31. But in terms of urgency, our primary concern right now is this tornado warning. I am getting word from the National Weather Service that that warning has been allowed to expire. So no more tornado warning, but that does not mean you are out of the woods weather-wise, because that severe thunderstorm warning is still in effect for that same general area. Obviously, tornadoes often spin out of severe thunderstorms, so stay alert. Keep listening to the radio. Keep, you know, make sure that your devices are with you. Any way that you have to be notified of tornado warnings or additional watches or additional severe thunderstorm warnings, keep them with you, because we are expecting this kind of weather to keep going for the rest of the evening. But that tornado warning for the city of Atchison has been allowed to expire. However, in Atchison, you do still have a severe thunderstorm warning until 6:30 tonight. That is for portions of Doniphan, Leavenworth, Atchison, Jackson, Buchanan, and Platt counties. Quarter-sized hail being reported, 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts. I'm going to check back with the National Weather Service, see what the very latest is. But good news, in the meantime, that tornado warning has been allowed to expire, and that is a relief. We hate to see it at any time, but particularly sort of during evening traffic and evening rush hour. So the tornado warning has been allowed to expire, but you do still have a severe thunderstorm warning until 6:30 tonight. And this particular set of storms, not joking around, quarter-sized hail, 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts, very dangerous storms, and again, tornadoes do spin out of them. So stay aware if you are in Atchison, Wathena, Dearborn, Camden Point, Rushville, Lewis and Clark Village, Donovan, DeKalb, Iatan, Bean Lake, Cummings, or Potter, you do have a severe thunderstorm warning until 6:30 this evening. We now return you to All Things Considered, already in progress, talking, of course, about the election. We will be talking shortly about terrible flooding in Spain. Stay tuned to KPR.
Election offices throughout the country spend a whole lot of time producing content for social media, and it always kills me when I see like 3 likes, and it's usually themselves and their mom. So I think election officials are trying to figure out, well, what else can I do to be heard?
So this cycle, what that looks like is a lot more press conferences and briefings for local news reporters and the public, just trying to educate people on exactly how their processes work ahead of the votes starting to be counted. These local election officials, though, are not really used to the limelight, but this cycle, there's just been this really, really clear recognition that they can't just sit back and wait and be defensive. They have to be proactive about some of this stuff.
And we're also seeing the federal government being more proactive, calling more of the stuff out publicly. Like just last week, there was this fake video going around of ballots being torn up in the swing state of Pennsylvania. And just a day later, we had intelligence officials come out publicly and say it was a Russian fake. We just haven't seen them move that quickly before. But I will say, Mary Louise, federal officials are really focused here on foreign actors who spread election lies. There's just not the same kind of effort to call out and warn Americans about, you know, falsehoods that might come from domestic sources. Of course, that can get into really fraught territory for the government because of the First Amendment. And it's also become a big line of attack for Republicans. And so that means a lot of this pushback and debunking is falling to local officials.
Okay, so that is some of what local and federal officials are trying to do. What about the tech platforms themselves? Because in past, of course, they have tried to limit the reach of false election information, and then they got accused of censorship. So, Shannon, how are they approaching election information at this point?
I mean, the starkest change really is at X. Musk himself is a huge source of false and misleading information about voting. That has many people really worried, right? Because X is small, but it remains influential. But as you said, you know, there are these accusations of censorship, and we've seen other platforms, including Facebook and YouTube, also retreat from what had been more aggressive approaches to countering election lies in 2020. And what we've been hearing for several years now is that amid all this pressure, everyone is just much more gun shy.
And then you add on top of that, what makes this really challenging for local election officials is that the landscape keeps changing. Isaac Kramer, who runs elections in South Carolina's Charleston County, told me he's been seeing a lot of false voting information on the community posting site Nextdoor, for instance.
It's difficult because there's a million different platforms out there, and we can't possibly have eyes on every platform and see what everything is being posted.
The time that voting officials are most worried about is after the vote has been completed, but counting is still going on. This information void has notoriously bred falsehoods, and Donald Trump has already made it clear he is not scared to declare victory even when he hasn't won.
I mean, these officials have spent years now talking to skeptical voters. Any evidence that outreach has worked?
I think there's some cautious optimism that people might be growing tired of the whole election denial narrative, but these internet platforms still reward sensationalist, partisan content, and until that changes, election officials are kind of fighting uphill.
It's NPR's Miles Parks and Shannon Bond. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At least 95 people have died in Spain after flash floods turned streets into rivers that swept cars away. The death toll is still climbing, and rain is still falling in vast areas of the country. NPR's Miguel Macias reports from Seville.
Dana is a word that many people in Spain had not heard before until today.
Como saben, ayer nuestro país fue golpeado por la peor dana en lo que llevamos de siglo.
Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez addressed the nation on Wednesday and declared 3 days of mourning. He said this was the worst DANA the country had seen this century. The term DANA is a Spanish acronym for high-level isolated depression. That's when cold air descends over the warm waters of the Mediterranean Sea, leading to the formation of dense, towering clouds in a matter of hours. The storm left images of destruction, especially in the region of Valencia, in the east. In the town of Picanha, neighbors watched how an entire bridge was swept away by an overflowing river.
We interrupt this broadcast of All Things Considered for a quick update on weather. The National Weather Service has issued a special weather statement for Jefferson, northeastern Shawnee, and southeastern Jackson counties through 6:45 this evening. Doppler radar tracking strong thunderstorms along a line extending from near Hoyt to about 5 miles west of Meriden to Topeka. The movement is to the northeast at 45 miles per hour. Strong wind gusts being reported with these storms, 50 to 55 miles per hour. Gusty winds could knock down tree limbs and blow around unsecured objects. If you are in North Topeka, Valley Falls, Oskaloosa, Tecumseh, Perry, McLouth, Meriden, Hoyt, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Winchester, Mayetta, Denison, at Perry Lake, or in Grantville, consider seeking shelter inside a building if you are outdoors. Again, strong thunderstorms moving through portions of Jefferson, Shawnee, and Jackson counties for about the next half hour. This is through 6:45 this evening. A special weather statement from the National Weather Service for Jefferson, Shawnee, and Jackson counties through 6:45. Strong thunderstorms moving through that area with wind gusts of 50 to 55 miles per hour. We also still have a severe thunderstorm warning for portions of Doniphan, Leavenworth, Atchison, Buchanan, and Platte counties until 6:30. This severe thunderstorm located near Nortonville, 11 miles southwest of Atchison, moving to the northeast at 50 miles per hour. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts associated with this storm, quarter-sized hail. Atchison, Wathena, Dearborn, Camden Point, Doniphan, Lewis and Clark Village, Rushville, Iatan, be aware. A severe thunderstorm moving through your area until 6:30 this evening. We'll continue to monitor the weather. I'll be back in a few moments with more. You are listening to KPR. And this is All Things Considered. We rejoin a story talking about a revamping of White House tours.
We wanted the new tour to mimic a museum experience.
As a teacher for 40 years, I know that we all learn in different ways. Some of us learn something through hearing. Some of us learn something through feeling something. So we've added a dynamic, flexible, and tactile tools of learning that let you follow your curiosity.
Like in the green room, where Elizabeth Alexander points to an urn used for tea or coffee that's almost 240 years old.
It's roped off because it belonged to John and Abigail Adams.
This is Laura Lorson in the KPR newsroom. Interrupting All Things Considered, a severe thunderstorm warning has now been issued for Jefferson County in northeastern Kansas, northeastern Shawnee County, and southeastern Jackson County. This is in effect until 7 o'clock tonight. Severe thunderstorms located along a line extending from near Denison to 3 miles north of Meriden to 3 miles northwest of Grantville. It's all moving to the northeast at 40 miles per hour. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts with this storm. Expect damage to roofs, siding, and trees. Locations affected by this severe thunderstorm warning include northeast Topeka, Valley Falls, Oskaloosa, McLouth, Meriden, Hoyt, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Winchester, Mayetta, Denison, Perry Lake, and Grantville. Again, this is a severe thunderstorm warning until 7 o'clock tonight for Jefferson County, Kansas, northeastern Shawnee County, and southeastern Jackson County. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts with this storm. If you're outdoors, you need to get indoors. Stay away from windows and stay tuned to I mean, I personally would prefer KPR, but make sure you stay tuned to some sort of news outlet that can tell you more about this set of severe thunderstorms, because tornadoes spin out of severe thunderstorms all the time. We just want you to stay safe. If you're not listening to us, listen to someone who can give you a heads up about these severe thunderstorms and possible tornadoes. We do have a tornado watch for that area until 10 o'clock tonight. Tornado watch for Chase County until 9 o'clock tonight. But for right now, a severe thunderstorm warning for Jefferson County in northeastern Kansas, northeastern Shawnee County, southeastern Jackson County till 7 o'clock tonight. We also have a severe thunderstorm warning for portions of Doniphan, Leavenworth, Atchison, Buchanan, and Platte counties until 6:30. You are listening to All Things Considered on Kansas Public Radio. We broadcast at 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.7 FM in Emporia, and many other frequencies all around the state. We are always streaming at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo, presenting Zoo Lights and the chance to host a private party or special event in a secluded igloo at the zoo. Details and reservations at topekazoo.org.
Stay tuned. News headlines are coming your way in just about another 12 minutes. Coming up in this next half hour, tell you about a new movie starring and directed by Jesse Eisenberg. We will find out why so many people are mourning a famous grizzly bear. And Nina Totenberg will talk about how the upcoming election could reshape the U.S. Supreme Court. It's all coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center at JCCC, presenting Hip-Rof, starring Colin Mockery and Asad Mekki, November 3rd, combining hypnosis and improv for a totally unique live comedy experience. Details at jccc.edu/mtc.
Once again, I want to remind you we have a severe thunderstorm warning now in effect for Jefferson County, Kansas, northeastern Shawnee County, southeastern Jackson County, in effect until 7 o'clock tonight. If you are in northeast Topeka, Valley Falls, Oskaloosa, McLouth, Meriden, Hoyt, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Winchester, Mayetta, Denison, Perry Lake, or Grantville, be aware you have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 7 o'clock tonight. We also have a severe thunderstorm warning for portions of Doniphan, Leavenworth, Atchison, Buchanan, and Platte counties. That one in effect until 6:30 tonight. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts, quarter-sized hail with those storms. Stay tuned to KPR. I'll keep watching the weather, and news headlines are coming up soon. It's 6:20.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
And this is Laura Lorson from the KPR Newsroom. Once again, we have a brand new severe thunderstorm warning for a similar area to one that is already in effect. This severe thunderstorm warning is for southwestern Jefferson County and southeastern Shawnee County. It is in effect until 6:45 tonight. Just about 4 minutes ago, a severe thunderstorm located near Pauline, moving to the northeast at 40 miles per hour, containing 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts. If you are in the city of Topeka, in Tecumseh, in Pauline, Grantville, or Berryton, or if you are on the Kansas Turnpike between mile markers 171 and 186, you need to take action now. If you are outdoors, you should be indoors. Get inside a sturdy building. Stay away from windows. You need to move to an interior room on the lowest floor of a building. Be aware that severe thunderstorms often spin off tornadoes, so you need to take cover now to get away from the damage and the threats of this severe thunderstorm. But we are also concerned about the possibility of a tornado spinning up from within it. So you should take shelter now in southwestern Jefferson County or southeastern Shawnee County. This particular thunderstorm warning in effect until 6:45 tonight. It is for the city of Topeka. It is for Tecumseh, Pauline, Grantville, and Berryton, or if you are on the Kansas Turnpike between mile markers 171 and 186, you have a severe thunderstorm warning until 6:45. We also have another severe thunderstorm warning for about another 8 minutes for portions of Doniphan County, Leavenworth County, Atchison County, Buchanan, and Platte counties. That's in effect until 6:30 tonight if you're in the city of Atchison. Wathena, Dearborn, Camden Point, DeKalb, Iatan, Lewis and Clark Village, you need to take shelter. If you are outdoors, get indoors. Again, that severe thunderstorm warning for Doniphan, Leavenworth, Atchison, Buchanan, and Platte counties. Quarter-sized hail with that storm, 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts. We also have an additional severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 7 o'clock tonight for additional portions of Jefferson, Shawnee, and Jackson counties. Again, this is in effect until 7 o'clock tonight. This is for northeast Topeka, Valley Falls, Oskaloosa, McLouth, Meriden, Hoyt, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Winchester, Mayetta, Denison, Perry Lake, and Grantville. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts with this storm. If you're outdoors, you need to get indoors. Move to an interior room on the lowest floor of a building. Stay away from windows. With wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour, we're concerned about debris falling out of trees, being picked up off the ground. Stay safe. Stay tuned to KPR. I'm going to check back in with the National Weather Service and be back in a moment. We now rejoin All Things Considered, already in progress.
There's two ways to get to the Havasupai Indian Reservation: a helicopter ride or an 8-mile, 2,000-foot descent into the depths of the Grand Canyon. Gallego, citing a phobia of helicopters from his years of service with the Marines, opted to walk.
So actually physically seeing it, seeing how they're attached to these causes makes a huge, huge difference and makes you want to fight harder, because now it's not just this theoretical thing. You're actually seeing it, right? You're seeing how this affects them.
The trail, shaded by steep Red Rock Canyon walls on either side, is full of reminders of why Gallego didn't get here sooner like he planned. Shattered trees and debris washed away by a deadly flash flood in August. The flood briefly shut down the village of Supai, a world-famous tourist destination, to visitors.
I'm surprised he made it down and walked down. A lot of people don't.
4 hours later, tribal elder Daly Manakaja looks on as Gallego, at hike's end, is welcomed by a ceremonial basket dance and lunch, Supai tacos, made with the village's famous fry bread. While sometimes dangerous, the water is what sustains the Havasupai people. And while this might be a campaign stop for Gallego, for the tribal leaders, it's a unique opportunity to sway a sitting congressman and possible U.S. senator to their cause. They're concerned a nearby uranium mine may taint the aquifer that's the key to the tourism economy, but more simply, life in Supai.
Our water, that's very important, our water down here. That, you know, we need to keep it alive just so we can go swimming. We can grow our crops down here.
The tribe made sure Gallego got to experience the bright blue-green water of Havasupai for himself. As Havasu Creek cascades over a roughly 100-foot cliff, Gallego takes a hard-earned break after the hike. He wades into the basin at the foot of the falls. But time is running out to meet his goal of visiting all of Arizona's federally recognized tribes. With Election Day less than a week away, the campaign says he's still got two tribes to go. Ben Giles, NPR News.
In Brazil, the trial has begun for one of the country's most notorious murders. Two former policemen stand accused of involvement in the assassination of an iconic Rio de Janeiro politician back in 2018. Investigations into the case exposed rampant corruption among police and politicians. Julia Carneiro reports from Rio de Janeiro.
This was a long-awaited moment for the protesters gathered outside Rio's courts today, calling for justice for Marielle Franco. They carried sunflowers, the symbol of the councilwoman's blooming career. It's impossible to underestimate how important a figure Marielle Franco was in Rio, a gay black woman from the favelas, advocating for human rights, gender, and racial equality. When she was gunned down, aged 38, along with driver Anderson Gomes, shock and protests echoed around the world. The men facing trial are former policeman Rony Lessa, who's accused of firing the submachine gun, and Elcio de Queiroz, who's accused of driving the car used in the crime. They made a plea deal with the federal...
We interrupt this broadcast of All Things Considered for a quick weather update. The National Weather Service has now issued a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Doniphan County, Buchanan County, Clinton County, Gentry County, Platt County, Andrew County, and DeKalb counties. Until 7:15 tonight, severe thunderstorms located along a line extending from near Country Club to near St. Joseph to near Dearborn. It's all moving to the northeast at 55 miles per hour. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts reported with this storm, quarter-sized hail. This does include the city of St. Joseph, Cameron, Savannah, Gower, Wathena, Elwood, Maysville, Country Club Villa, Country Club, King City, Stewartsville, Agency, Dearborn, Union Star, Osborne, Amazonia, Clarksdale, Easton, DeKalb, and Cosby. It includes I-35 in Missouri near mile marker 49, I-29 between mile markers 29 and 59, and Interstate 229 between mile markers 0 and 14. That severe thunderstorm warning for portions of Doniphan, Buchanan, Clinton, Gentry, Platt, Andrew, and DeKalb counties in effect until 7:15 tonight. That does include the city of St. Joseph. We also have two sort of overlapping severe thunderstorm warnings, one for Jefferson County, portions of Shawnee, and portions of Jackson County until 7 o'clock tonight. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts. This is for northeastern Topeka, Valley Falls, Oskaloosa, McLouth, Meriden, Hoyt, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Winchester, Mayetta, Denison, Perry Lake, and Grantville. We also have a severe thunderstorm warning until 6:45 for different portions of Jefferson County and Shawnee County. This is for the city of Topeka, Tecumseh, Pauline, Grantville, and Berryton. It also includes the Kansas Turnpike between mile markers 171 and 186. And again, that severe thunderstorm warning that includes the city of Topeka is in effect until 6:45. In all of these cases, if you are outdoors, you need to get indoors. We are concerned about those wind gusts. Debris is a huge threat. Anything that is lying around on the ground, anything that isn't tied down, 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts can certainly move that. So you want to get indoors if you're outdoors. Get inside a sturdy shelter. Stay away from windows. Again, that flying debris can break your windows. You don't want to get injured. So get to an interior room of a sturdy building to wait this out. The severe thunderstorm warning for Jefferson and Shawnee County until 6:45. That does include the city of Topeka, Tecumseh, Pauline, Grantville, and Berryton. The other one in effect until 7 o'clock tonight for a different portion of Jefferson, Shawnee, and Jackson counties in effect until 7 o'clock tonight. That covers northeast Topeka, Valley Falls, Oskaloosa, McLouth, Meriden, Hoyt, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Winchester, Mayetta, Denison, Perry Lake, and Grantville. We are also dealing with a tornado watch till 9 o'clock tonight for Chase County. Virtually all of the rest of the KPR listening area under a tornado watch until 10 o'clock tonight. It includes Topeka, Lawrence, the Kansas City Metro, and Chanute. We're going to pick up very quickly a couple of minutes of national news, and I'll be back in just a moment. It's 6:30.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Supreme Court is allowing Virginia to resume its purge of registered voters that the Commonwealth says removes foreign nationals from the rolls. But as NPR's Jude Jaffe Block tells us, U.S. citizens have also been affected.
In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court granted Virginia's emergency appeal to block a lower court ruling that would have stopped Virginia's voter purge and would have promptly restored 1,600 voters to the rolls. Instead, Virginia can continue its purge and does not need to restore voters to the rolls. But Virginia does allow in-person voter registration through Election Day, so eligible U.S. citizens who were mistakenly removed from the rolls can still vote in this election. Jude Jaffe Block, NPR News.
Many teachers in the federally funded Head Start program work odd jobs to just make ends meet. Low pay has also led to a staffing crisis where last year nearly 1 in 5 Head Start teachers quit. NPR's Corey Turner says the average salary is around $40,000 a year compared to a preschool teacher who earns about $53,000 a year on average.
The Biden-Harris administration has created a rule requiring Head Start teachers to get a pay pump of as much as $10,000 a person. Here's the problem. Without Congress, local program directors are being told they have to pay for it, in some cases by cutting services. With the election just a week away, it's also worth noting the Republican Project 2025 calls for eliminating Head Start. We know Donald Trump has disavowed that project. I did ask his campaign for his position, and I got a vague quote about returning education to the states.
That's NPR's Corey Turner. Scientists say an ancient tadpole similar to ones found today is the oldest ever discovered. This one wiggled around 160 million years ago and was found in what is now Argentina. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Probably going to be spending most of it talking about the weather. We have quite a bit of severe weather moving through the KPR listening area at this hour. A severe thunderstorm warning is in effect for portions of southwestern Jefferson and southeastern Shawnee counties. That severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 6:45 tonight. Locations affected by this severe thunderstorm include Topeka, Tecumseh, Pauline, Grantville, and Berryton, and also the Kansas Turnpike between mile markers 171 and 186. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts reported with this set of severe thunderstorms. The warned area, again, southwestern Jefferson, southeastern Shawnee County. It does include the city of Topeka. Now, sort of overlapping this area, we have a different severe thunderstorm warning. This one in effect until 7 o'clock tonight. It is for Jefferson County, also northeastern Shawnee County and southeastern Jackson County. Again, this one in effect until 7 o'clock tonight. Again, 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts reported with this storm. Roof damage, siding damage, tree damage possible with those kind of winds. Locations affected include northeast Topeka, Valley Falls, Oskaloosa, McLouth, Meriden, Hoyt, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Winchester, Mayetta, Denison, Perry Lake, and Grantville. We also have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 7:15 tonight. This covers the city of St. Joseph. This severe thunderstorm warning for portions of Doniphan, Buchanan, Clinton, Gentry, Platte, Andrew, and DeKalb counties. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts, quarter-sized hail if you are in St. Joseph, Cameron, Savannah, Gower, Wathena, Elwood, Maysville, Country Club Villa, Country Club, King City, Stewartsville, Agency, DeKalb, Cosby, or on I-35 in Missouri near mile marker 49, I-29 between mile markers 29 and 59, or Interstate 229 between mile markers 0 and 14. You should get inside shelter now. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts, quarter-sized hail associated with these storms. Otherwise, we do still have several tornado watches. We are expecting this weather to be moving through this region till about 11 o'clock tonight. Stay tuned. Make sure you have multiple outlets for receiving weather information. Tornadoes often spin up out of severe thunderstorms, and you won't have much warning, so make sure you have some way to be warned. Tornado watch until 9 o'clock tonight for Chase County. Tornado watch till 10 o'clock tonight for Allen, Anderson, Atchison, Coffee, Doniphan, Douglas, Franklin, Greenwood, Jackson, Jefferson, Johnson, Leavenworth, Lynn, Lyon, Miami, Morris, Neosho, Osage, Shawnee, Waubonsie, Wilson, Woodson, and Wyandotte counties in Kansas, Andrew, Bates, Buchanan, Clay, Holt, Jackson, Nottoway, Platte, and Ray counties in Missouri. That does include Lawrence, Topeka, the Kansas City Metro, and Chanute. It's 6:35.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Well, it's less than a week until the last votes are cast in this year's presidential election, and the candidates are crisscrossing the country, making their final pitches. Former President Trump is doing so while dealing with lingering controversy from his major rally in New York City on Sunday, though he is hammering on a remark made by President Biden. NPR political correspondent Daniel Kurtzleben is following the Trump campaign and joins us now. Hi, Danielle.
Hey there.
So I see how every day is so packed with events this close to Election Day. What is Trump up to today?
Well, he was in Rocky Mount, North Carolina for a rally this afternoon. So not only a swing state, but that's also where there's this House district that Republicans have a shot at flipping from a Democratic seat. Now, tonight, Trump has a rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin, with former Packers quarterback Brett Favre. Now, as for his message, his rally today was mostly pretty standard for Trump. He talked about his plan to do mass deportations. He also talked about inflation. But also, as you mentioned there, he really railed against this comment that President Biden made Tuesday night. Biden had been talking about Trump's Sunday Madison Square Garden rally, where at that rally, a comedian referred to Puerto Rico as a, quote, floating island of garbage. Biden, in talking about this, stumbled over his words, and it momentarily sounded like he was calling Trump supporters garbage.
Huh. Okay, so you have this comment from Biden, and you have a series of racist and misogynist comments from that New York rally. Tell us how Trump addressed all of that today, did he?
Well, regarding the Biden comment, very much. He talked about that as if Biden insulted Trump supporters. But if you listen to Biden's full statement, grammatically, garbage refers to that insulting joke about Puerto Rico. But Trump is clearly seeing this as an opportunity to get out from under the shadow of this rally. He's linking Harris and Walz to Biden in the process. Here he was today.
You can't lead America if you don't love Americans. You just can't. And you can't be president if you hate the American people. And there's a lot of hatred there.
And it really harkens back to Hillary Clinton in 2016 calling some Trump supporters a basket of deplorables. Well, Trump seized on that back then. And even today, some Trump supporters still claim that deplorables mantle. But all of that said here, let's keep in mind that Trump's message isn't exactly peace and love and unity. He, after all, has called the U.S. a, quote, garbage can for the world recently in reference to immigration.
Okay, well, despite trying to draw attention to Biden's comments, Trump is still fielding a lot of criticism from that New York rally, right?
Very much. The Trump campaign has distanced itself from that one specific joke about Puerto Rico, but they haven't really answered for the other vulgar statements made at that rally. And there were a lot of those statements about Kamala Harris, about women, about Latinos as a whole. Plus, Tucker Carlson told the crowd that political leaders are trying to replace American voters, which is a reference to the racist great replacement theory. Mm-hmm. At any rate, Trump is doing this very broad cleanup. He has called the New York rally a love fest. And at a rally in Pennsylvania last night, he said, quote, nobody loves our Latino community and our Puerto Rican community more than I do.
Okay. So aside from that, it sounds like Trump gave a pretty standard speech at today's Rocky Mount rally. What should people be watching for in these final stops for the Trump campaign?
Well, again, his central message is always immigration, inflation, and isolationism. There's often some grievance mixed in with that, but just as central to his message is his persona. He's unpredictable. He's often insulting to his opponents. He's recently been calling Kamala Harris low IQ or stupid. None of this is a policy position, but his faithful voters love that side of him. They see it as a sign of honesty. And that's honesty they perceive from a guy who also continues to lie about the 2020 election.
That is NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you.
Jesse Eisenberg's new movie, A Real Pain, is based on his own family history. Eisenberg cast himself and Succession's Kieran Culkin as polar opposites. Critic Bob Mondello says the result is an odd couple road trip comedy that surprises.
Cousins David and Benji have been best pals since infancy. Now in their early 30s, David is antsy, anxious, and neurotic, which is to say he's played by Jesse Eisenberg. Kieran Culkin's Benji is loose, cool, and to David's distress at the film's start, not picking up his phone.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system.
Boner.
Is not available.
Hey, Benji, I just got to the airport. I really hope you left already. God, you made it.
What's up, cuz?
They are headed to Poland on what someone will later call a Holocaust tour to see the village their late grandmother hailed from. Both have come prepared, David with a carefully planned itinerary, Benji with supplies.
Wait, you're not, like, taking weed into Poland, are you?
Oh, yeah. Benji? They don't give a shit about that stuff.
Mm, I think they very much do.
Arriving in Warsaw, they meet their mostly older group, which includes a recent divorcee, a Rwandan genocide survivor, and a guide who's not Jewish but says he's obsessed with the Jewish experience. In a way, so are David and Benji.
In some parallel black hole universe, you and I are Polish, and we probably got, like, long beards and we can't shake hands with women.
Yeah, that's funny. You know, every time I see, like, one of those Hasidic guys on the street, I always just think, like, there but for the grace of no God, go I, you know?
What?
Oh, nothing. It's just, like, a dumb joke.
Mm. Oh, that's cool, man.
Benji's already moved on.
Look at her. And that woman, Marcia. She's walking alone. We should go talk to her.
We just met her.
Yeah, but she's got this, like, deep sadness behind her eyes. You know?
We interrupt this broadcast of All Things Considered for a quick update on the weather situation. I'm Laura Lorson. A severe thunderstorm warning remains in effect for another few minutes for southwestern Jefferson and southeastern Shawnee counties. This severe thunderstorm, located over southeastern Topeka, is moving to the northeast at 50 miles per hour with 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts. Locations affected include Topeka, Tecumseh, Pauline, Grantville, and Berryton. This includes the Kansas Turnpike between mile markers 171 and 186, in effect until 6:45. We also have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 7 o'clock tonight for Jefferson, northeastern Shawnee, and southeastern Jackson counties. These storms located along a line extending from near Nortonville to about 4 miles west of Winchester to near Perry Lake. It's all moving to the northeast at 45 miles per hour. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts with this storm if you are in northeast Topeka. Valley Falls, Oskaloosa, McClouth, Meriden, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Winchester, Grantville, or at Perry Lake. Be aware, this storm is going to be affecting you if it is not already. Severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 7 o'clock tonight. If you're outdoors, you should get indoors. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts can be incredibly damaging. Damage to roofs, siding, trees, and more. Debris is the big concern, particularly flying debris. So get inside a sturdy shelter. We also have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 7:15 tonight for portions of Doniphan, Buchanan, Clinton, Gentry, Andrew, and DeKalb counties. This does include the city of St. Joseph. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts with this storm. Quarter-sized hail. Hail damage is expected with this storm. Again, that is for Doniphan, Buchanan, Clinton, Gentry, Andrew, and DeKalb counties. A severe thunderstorm warning, including the city of St. Joseph, until 7:15 tonight. I'm going to gather more information and come back in just a moment. You're listening to KPR.
Beloved residents of the ecosystem around Yellowstone National Park has died. She was an often photographed grizzly bear known as 399. That's a number that wildlife biologists assigned her. 399 was the oldest known reproducing female grizzly in the area, and she died last week after being struck by a car. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach spoke to people mourning the loss.
My name is Tom Mangelson, year after year for 18 years. I would see her and her offspring.
Mangelson is a wildlife photographer that lives near Grand Teton National Park. People around the world got to know 399 through his photos.
I don't have kids, but I have a couple of special dogs and have had animals all my life, but I've never lost an animal that affected me as much as 399 getting killed.
399 was known as a roadside bear. Grizzlies that survive to age 28, like she did, generally avoid people. But there's a hypothesis.
We interrupt this broadcast of All Things Considered to bring you another weather alert. A severe thunderstorm warning has now been issued for northern Franklin County, southern Jefferson County, southeastern Shawnee County, and Douglas County, along with northeastern Osage County. This is in effect until 7:30 tonight. Severe thunderstorms located along a line extending from near Grantville to near Overbrook to 3 miles north of Pomona Lake. It's all moving to the east at 45 miles per hour. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts associated with this storm. Expect damage to roofs, siding, and trees. Locations affected by this severe thunderstorm include southeastern Topeka, the city of Lawrence, Baldwin City, Tecumseh, Eudora, Richland, Wellsville, Overbrook, Centropolis, Perry, Lecompton, Clinton, Lone Star, Pleasant Grove, Vinland, Williamstown, Grantville, Clinton Lake, Globe, and Berryton. It includes I-35 near mile marker 198 and the Kansas Turnpike between mile markers 182 and 205. If you are in northern Franklin, southern Jefferson, southeastern Shawnee, any part of Douglas or northeastern Osage counties, you need to get indoors if you are outdoors. Move to an interior room on the lowest floor of a building. Again, tornadoes often spin up out of these severe thunderstorms. We are particularly concerned about that tonight because of the level of wind shear we are seeing at upper levels of the atmosphere. So northern Franklin County, southern Jefferson County, southeastern Shawnee County, Douglas County, northeastern Osage County, a severe thunderstorm warning for you until 7:30 tonight. That includes southeast Topeka, the city of Lawrence, Baldwin City, Tecumseh, Eudora, Richland, Wellsville, Overbrook, Centropolis, Perry, Lecompton, Clinton, Lone Star, Pleasant Grove, Vinland, Williamstown, Grantville, Clinton Lake, Globe, and Berryton. If you're on I-35 near mile marker 198 or the Kansas Turnpike between mile markers 182 and 205, be ready to be driving into a set of severe thunderstorms moving through this area through 7:30 tonight. We also have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for southeastern Doniphan County, Buchanan County, Clinton County, Gentry County, Platte County, Andrew, and DeKalb counties until 7:15. That includes the city of St. Joseph. Also with these storms, 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts, quarter-sized hail. We do still have a different severe thunderstorm warning for portions of Jefferson, Shawnee, and Jackson counties until 7 o'clock tonight. 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts with those storms. That includes northeast Topeka, Valley Falls, Oskaloosa, McLouth, Meriden, Hoyt, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Winchester, Mayetta, Denison, Perry Lake, and Grantville. Again, you are listening to KPR, Kansas Public Radio, interrupting quite a bit of All Things Considered this evening to bring you updates on the weather that is affecting the region. We do have a tornado watch until 9 o'clock tonight for Chase County. We have a tornado watch until 10 o'clock tonight for Allen, Anderson, Atchison, Coffee, Doniphan, Douglas, Franklin, Greenwood, Jackson, Jefferson, Johnson, Leavenworth, Lynn, Lyon, Miami, Morris, Neosho, Osage, Shawnee, Waubonsie, Wilson, Woodson, and Wyandotte counties in Kansas, Andrew, Bates, Buchanan, Clay, Holt, Jackson, Nottoway, Platte, and Ray counties in Missouri. This includes Topeka, Lawrence, Emporia, the Kansas City Metro, and Chanute. Kansas City suburbs haven't really seen a lot of this yet, but I assure you it is all moving your direction. This is all moving through this area until 10 or 11 o'clock tonight, so stay tuned to KPR. Make sure you have multiple means of getting warnings about these tornado watches and about severe thunderstorm warnings. We want you to stay safe, but particularly since the sun has set, we are now expecting these storms to really ramp up because of the instability in the atmosphere. We need you to stay safe. Once again, we do have a severe thunderstorm warning for portions of Franklin, Jefferson, Shawnee, Douglas, and Osage County tonight until 7:30. This does include southeast Topeka and the city of Lawrence. We now return you to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The upcoming election, now less than a week away, could reshape the U.S. Supreme Court, or not, depending on retirements, deaths, and other unforeseen events. The only certainty is the potential for political struggle. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Depending on who wins the presidential election and control of the Senate, the current 6-3 conservative supermajority could remain the same, be trimmed to 5-4, or expand to an even larger and more lopsided conservative majority. The public, for the most part, understands that if there's a Supreme Court vacancy, the president's nominee will generally reflect the president's views. But there is a genuine possibility that if the Senate is controlled by the opposition party, any open seat will remain unfilled. Not for months, but for years. Indeed, there is also a real possibility that lower court seats will go unfilled, unless there's significant backroom horse trading. In short, with power split between the White House and the Senate, there could be unprecedented gridlock on judicial nominations that extends all the way up to the Supreme Court and down to the appellate and even district courts. In recent years, Republicans have wielded their power in unprecedented ways to prevent a Democratic president from filling a Supreme Court vacancy. They did that in 2016, blocking any consideration of Obama nominee Merrick Garland for nearly a year. 4 years later, with Trump in the White House when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, Senate Republicans rapidly pushed through the confirmation of Judge, now Justice, Amy Coney Barrett just weeks before the election. This year, conservatives are even more determined to keep or expand their 6-3 Supreme Court majority. So what happens if Kamala Harris is elected president, but the Senate flips to Republican control?
They just say, we're going to give you the Merrick Garland treatment.
Conservative scholar Josh Blackman.
We'll have a seat open for 3 or 4 years.
Would the reverse happen if Trump is elected, but the Senate remains in Democratic hands? Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman, who's written extensively about the court's history, says that Republicans essentially crossed the Rubicon in 2016 with the Garland nomination.
Given that, we're now, I think, in a world where following the controversial conservative revolutionary decisions that have come at the court, neither party would be likely to give a positive vote to a nominee of the president from the opposite party.
Democrats like to think of themselves as more responsible than Republicans, but the pressure would be enormous to do unto Republicans what they did to the Democrats. NYU law professor Bob Bauer served as White House counsel for 2 years during the Obama administration. He isn't sure what Democrats would do if the shoe's on the other foot, but
this whole notion of a certain process that has to be respected, regardless of the potential political impact on one party or the other, is not a norm because it doesn't command general adherence.
So what if Trump is elected and the Senate flips to Republican control? The only thing then standing between nomination and confirmation would be two moderate Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. If the margin is 52-48, their votes aren't needed. Vice President J.D. Vance would cast the tie-breaking vote. So what recourse would the Democrats have in a situation like that? How would they fight a Trump nomination? We would largely be left with the politics of personal destruction, investigating every aspect of a nominee's life to find something disqualifying, said one Democrat who spoke candidly on condition of anonymity. Of course, right now, there is no vacant seat on the Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor, at age 70, the oldest Democratic appointee, has said emphatically that she has no plans to retire. And while the deaths of Justices Scalia and Ginsburg prove that nothing is certain, they were far older than any of the current members of the Supreme Court. Today, the two oldest justices are among the most conservative. Clarence Thomas is 76 and Samuel Alito, 74. Some of the most politically active conservative thinkers would like to see them step down and be replaced by younger conservative judges who could serve for many decades longer and move the conservative needle even further to the right. But those who know Thomas and Alito are adamant that neither man would leave the court at this point. Several of their friends agreed to speak candidly about the prospect of retirement if they were not identified by name. What would Alito do, asked one friend? Go home and fly flags with his wife at the beach? The court is his life, said another. As for Thomas, while some theorize that he might enjoy retirement, his close friends say there's no way he would retire. They say he would see that as caving into his critics and essentially being driven off the court. Thomas is by far the most senior member of the current court. Indeed, after the next president is sworn in, the justice will be serving during his 11th presidential administration. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
My baby born in Birkin. She's been telling me all night long.
Ever since the middle of the summer, this had been at the top of the pop charts.
We interrupt this broadcast of All Things Considered to bring you a quick weather update. A severe thunderstorm warning still in effect for portions of the KPR listening area, and by portions I mean a whole lot of the KPR listening area. Severe thunderstorm warning for about another 5 minutes for central Jefferson and northeastern Shawnee counties, including northeastern Topeka, Oskaloosa, McLouth, Ozaukee, Nortonville, Perry Lake, and Grantville. We have a severe thunderstorm warning until 7:30 tonight for portions of Franklin, Jefferson, Shawnee, Douglas, and Osage counties. This includes southeastern Topeka, the city of Lawrence, Baldwin City, Tecumseh, Eudora, Richland, Wellsville, Overbrook, Centropolis, Perry, Lecompton, Clinton, Lone Star, Pleasant Grove, Vinland, Williamstown, Grantville, Clinton Lake, Globe, and Berryton. We also have a severe thunderstorm warning now for portions of Greenwood, Wilson, and Woodson counties. This is in effect until 7:45 tonight. 70-mile-an-hour wind gusts with those storms and quarter-sized hail. That could include Neodesha, Fredonia, Longton, Toronto, Severy, Fall River, Buxton, Fall River Lake, and Cross Timbers State Park. So that is where we stand with these warnings right now. We're going to take you back for the end of this story about Shibuzi, and then I will come back to wrap things up with yet another weather roundup here on KPR.
Vivian, one advantage of the current system with its fickle nature is that it can offer a snapshot of fan sentiment in the moment. After former One Direction member Liam Payne died on October 16th, one way fans mourned was to stream the One Direction catalog. This week, all five One Direction studio albums re-entered the album chart. Seems to me that when I die, these words will be written on my stone. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music. And I'll be gone, gone tonight. The ground beneath my feet is open wide. The way that I've been holding on too tight, with nothing in between. The story of my life, I take her home.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations with their food needs, with online ordering from a nationwide network of restaurants, flexible employee lunch programs, and more, all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
We're in the final stretch of this historic election season. I'm Scott Detrow. Join us for live special coverage of Election Night 2024 from NPR News.
You can hear that special coverage on Tuesday the 5th, that night, beginning at 7 o'clock, immediately following All Things Considered. We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Topeka's Noto Arts and Entertainment District, featuring a celebration of souls, Day of the Dead in southern Mexico, exploring the Dia de los Muertos holiday traditions and origins, now till December 14th. Information at explorenoto.org.
The severe thunderstorm warning for central Jefferson and northeastern Shawnee counties will be allowed to expire, so we'll cross that one off the list. Here are the ones that are still in effect. A severe thunderstorm warning until 7:15 for portions of Doniphan, Buchanan, Clinton, Gentry, Andrew, and DeKalb counties, including the city of St. Joe.